Well, good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, whichever the case may be. On this rotating globe, welcome to another edition, live tonight. God willing, and the creek don't rise, and the infrastructure holds. You're on the other side of midnight, that magical time between dusk and dawn, where we literally talk about anything. And tonight, we're going to be talking about primarily what the amazing things that the Odysseus spacecraft launched by Intuitive Machines, a private company there in Houston, Texas. For the first time in 52 years, an American spacecraft was landed softly, I guess kind of, on the moon's surface. Now, it wasn't a manned craft. It wasn't, you know, with astronauts. It wasn't Artemis. It was a precursor, part of the NASA's so-called CLPS program, which is commercial lunar transport by NASA. Instead of building spacecraft and going to the moon in terms of science, in terms of environmental reconnaissance for Artemis, they are making private contracts with private corporations. They fly instruments. The corporation designs the spacecraft, builds the spacecraft, launches the spacecraft, operates the spacecraft, controls the spacecraft, and NASA basically downlinks data. At least that's the model. And on this mission, some very curious things happened, which we're going to go through this morning. We've got a very important special guest with us. We've got Nova Spivak, by the way, spelled with a K. We'll correct that. Because Nova has an actual experimental package on board this particular mission, which they goodnighted because of failing sun. You know, the moon rotates every month, and so you get 2 weeks of light and 2 weeks of darkness. I remember that wonderful line by George Carlin, you know, the hippy-dippy weatherman, and he said something at one point, you know, well, there'll be darkness followed by light. On the moon, it's light followed by darkness, and then you wait 2 weeks, and then you have light again. And the spacecraft was not designed to last a lunar night. None of the current crop of spacecraft seem to be designed to last a lunar night, even though half a century ago, 50 years ago, we had spacecraft like Surveyor that I joked to Homer Newell one day. I said, you're going to have to go up there and beat it to death with a stick, because they couldn't get it to shut up. It kept, every time the sun would rise, it would come back on the air, and it was tubes and printed circuits and mirrors, multiple, you know, aluminized mirrors on cases outside the frame of the spacecraft. It was primitive. It was, as again, you know, I kind of like that overused line from Spock. It was the equivalent of stone, knives, and bearskins in the space age. And we nailed 5 out of 7. The roster of current missions going to the moon and successfully landing, meaning they ignite their retro rockets, they arc down smoothly, they flare before the landing, they touch down at less than a foot per second, and they sit there upright. Well, the last two missions, both the Japanese government mission called SLIM and the U.S. private mission launched by Intuitive Machines called Odysseus, have landed in very peculiar ways. The SLIM mission literally turned upside down, roll down a crater or whatever, but it's functioning. And the Odysseus spacecraft landed hard. You could see on the landing video it actually break 2 of its landing struts of the 6. It then gracefully, in about 2 seconds we're told, kind of tilted over and is now standing at about a 30-degree angle to the lunar surface. But all of the instruments on board were functioning until Odysseus was gently put to bed, the electronics carefully prepared, so that when they send in a couple weeks a wake-up call, it may respond. Because the Japanese mission, SLIM, in its peculiar configuration in Mare Nectaris, remember the Odysseus mission landed within 10 degrees of the lunar south pole, in an area called Malapart A. Whenever you see crater names with like A, B, C, those are the satellite craters around a big one which is just named like Malapart or Shoemaker or whatever. So it's at the South Pole, near, within 10 degrees, which is about 180 miles. And it's seeing all kinds of astonishing things. One of the complications is that the imagery has been arranged so it's not easy for the layman, the lay person, to interpret what they're seeing. So I'm going to kind of take you through a little viewer's guide of what to reject and what to accept in the images before we find out more detail from Intuitive Machines as to how they've designed their optics, because there is only one regular format camera on the spacecraft, as near as I can tell. There are several wide-angle lenses, ultra-wide-angle, like 180 degrees. And the good news is there are commercial programs available on the Internet where you take these circular images, which are fisheye lens images, kind of like the ones people used to put in their front yard sitting on a flamingo stand, like a silver ball. And then they would take pictures and you get the entire sky behind you and all that. Well, those are called fisheye views or fisheye lenses. There are programs which convert from the fisheye view to a normal view. And so when you do that, and other people have done it, this is where you get the stunning confirmation that whatever is above Odysseus at the South Pole of the moon is not supposed to be there. So we will delve into that more very shortly. What I want to do is start with some news, because I want to give some context. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, that's our URL, and you want to click on tonight's banner, which says very dramatically, Copperfield's disappearing moon and the Odysseus lunar landing mystery, with Nova Spivak and the ET team for March 2nd. This is Saturday night, March 2nd. We'll refer to that a couple more times during the show. Click on that banner. That will take you to the guest page. And under that banner on the guest page, which is near the top, you will see a line which says fast links to items. Click on my name. And that will take you to the section of radio with pictures where we have links and videos and imagery and all that kind of good stuff. So item number one, we are now in the fifth month, I forget. It's horrible, of the war between Israel and Gaza, between Israel and the Hamas terrorists running Gaza. There are 2 million people that are literally in a free fire zone who are now in danger, not just of being bombed to death. Over 30,000 people have died. Most of them are civilians. Most of them are not Hamas. Even a major fraction are not Hamas. They're just ordinary, innocent civilians being pummeled to death from the skies for no good reason. And we are supporting them. We, the United States, we are supporting the Netanyahu government for no good reason. There has been discussion for decades of the so-called Israeli lobby on Capitol Hill. Well, I think you're seeing, you know, obvious evidence of an Israeli lobby, which literally is permitting and condoning and conducive to genocide. There's no other way to describe what's going on in Gaza. It is the human condition. It is the penultimate reason why, unless something changes, unless the human race is brought directly into contact with information that it's just a tiny speck in a huge populated universe where this kind of stuff is not permitted. It does not go on. In other words, reconnecting with our real ancient galactic history. And I know a lot of you are going to go, what? When you confirm with an obvious independent mission, with independent sets of cameras, that there's something phenomenal about the moon that is not part of the conventional model, you have to extrapolate the implications of that, which is we know almost nothing, not only about what's out there, but obviously about what's here in terms of our own history. So tonight, in an effort to bring some kind of sanity where we as a U.S. don't supply bombs to Israel on the one hand and send cargo planes dropping, you know, 38,000 meals, there are 2 million starving people in Gaza tonight. 2 million that the U.N. and a whole raft of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, as they're called, are all assessing independently the starvation potential for Gaza is cataclysmic. It is, we're looking at potentially hundreds of thousands of children dying, millions of people dying, not of bombs, not of bullets, but of simple, crude, awful starvation. And we send 38,000 meals, you know, to, ready to eat for a population of 2 million. We would need 100 times those flights every day to just give every one of those people one meal per day, a very small meal. So the only thing I can see in the foreseeable future that can change this horrible equation is if there is acknowledgement that we are part of a much larger intelligent ecosystem that extends far beyond the earth, involves individuals, peoples, species, whatever, that we have no direct knowledge of. It's all being filtered through sources that are incredibly suspect. And the only thing that will allow us to figure out what our real connection is with these other folks is to find libraries on the moon that were put there by our great, great, great ancestors or potentially extraterrestrial species, all designed when we reach the appropriate technological level, we go to the moon, we find these archives, and we finally figure out how we relate to the larger cosmic whole. Item number two, Odyssey, it's like wanting to say Odyssey because NASA named two spacecraft so similarly from similar memes. The Odyssey spacecraft, or IM-1, Intuitive Machine 1, the company there in Houston that built it, designed it, built it, and sent it and landed it, and apparently 350 megabytes of data were sent back to Earth. Some of it we're going to talk about tonight, these astonishing, incredibly astonishing images. Well, in item number two, given that the mission planners did not design Odysseus to survive a lunar night, they put it to bed with a final picture sent to Earth, which is really amazing. It shows a crescent Earth to the left of the sun from a spacecraft hovering about 1,500 feet above the lunar surface, descending, and is going to land much harder than they wanted to, but they survived. You know, the old pilot's joke, you know, any landing that you can walk away from is a successful landing. Well, they didn't stick the landing, but it's there, it's upright, and on it is some amazing things that we're going to talk about very shortly. I want you to all now go to number three, because for the rest of the morning, we're going to talk about this as a backdrop. If you click on number three, this is a graphic that I created a few hours ago. On the left is a glittering glass computerized model based on the Apollo 10 data and other NASA data I was analyzing back in the mid-1990s, starting in 94. And in 1996, if you click on that, you'll see that I presented this potential lunar architecture and a whole bunch of lunar experts at a press club briefing at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., just stone's throw from the White House. And what I've done now is on the left-hand side, I put one of our architectural models created by me and an architect named Bob Firtek, who was a young architectural student in Connecticut. And we worked on it together. I brought him to the National Space Science Data Center as part of a team of like seven or eight people that we spent a couple of days there looking at Apollo imagery. And on the right-hand side, I put a close-up of the sun shining on the Odysseus spacecraft at this 1,500-foot altitude. And you can see the incredible glass forward scattering geometric boxes, the crystalline glittering glass boxes that are in this area above the moon, between the moon and the sun. You can see them there, and they look identical geometrically to what the model was in 1996. So if science is nothing if it's not prediction, we have posted the data side by side, and it is now up to Intuitive Machines and NASA to explain why they're giving us this stunning data. But they're not saying a word about what's in the pictures. And it, before you instantly say, oh, it's just lens flare. No, it's not lens flare. And this morning we'll go through in the next 3 hours why it's not lens flare. So before we get to anything else, I want to bring in my friend and colleague, Nova Spivak, who is the prime mover from the Arch Mission Foundation to put archives on spacecraft leaving Earth ever since the Beresheet mission back in, what was it, Nova, 2018?
Well, it was 2019.
But you started it, you know.
We started it long before
that. Yeah, long before that. Anyway, so Nova Spivak is probably the humanity's chief archivist, not to go and find archives by ETs on the moon, but to implant our own for both ET someday or maybe our own descendants in the dim, dim, distant future. And the third time's a charm because you tried for three. Beresheet was the first one. The archive is there. We know it's under the dirt. The second one, Peregrine, perished over the South Pacific because that mission did not succeed because of technical issues. But the third time, it's sitting there. It's upright, kind of. It's going to be there forever. And the archive itself, now that you know it's upright and protected, probably, I've seen estimates that it could last maybe a billion years or more. Nova, talk to us about this success.
Well, thanks. We are very happy that we finally did succeed at landing. As you said, it did take several attempts at great expense, both in labor and money, and you know, lots and lots of people working for, you know, over a decade to do this. We really have been working on this for more than 16 years. Our first mission was really with Elon Musk, where we put.
Oh, that's right. How could I forget that
one? So that was the Isaac Asimov Foundation trilogy in his Tesla Roadster glove compartment.
Yep.
In quartz silica glass. Inside the glass. So it's etched into the glass using a femtosecond laser. And that's a 14 billion year durability storage medium. So that will probably last longer than the Tesla.
It will last when the sun expands to become a red giant.
Right.
Unless the Roadster and the rocket it's attached to encounters Jupiter.
Well, there's no Roadster. There's no rocket anymore. It's just a piece of ballast they shot out into space.
You mean the Roadster is by itself orbiting the sun?
Yeah, they just shot it out there as a, you know.
Okay, well, if it ever encounters Mars in the right direction, that will flip it into an even more elongated orbit, and then all it has to do is cross the orbit of Jupiter, and then at some point Jupiter could eject it from the solar system. So by the time the sun dies in like 5 billion years, this little quartz crystalline set of discs you put in that glove compartment could be anywhere in the Milky Way galaxy, still surviving.
It could be, or it could be recovered and be, you know, in some museum on
planet. No, you have to absolutely insist that not happen. No. Do not let the Smithsonian people.
Earth. No. I don't think so. I think it might be recovered by, you know, aliens and put into their museum.
Yes, that's the whole idea. Yeah. You know, back when Carl and I and Eric started this cottage industry. You know the story that Eric and I were visiting JPL, and there was a pause in a mission. It was Mariner 9 in 1972, which was supposed to go into orbit around Mars and give us the first close-up pictures. Well, they had this dust storm cover the entire planet. So we had a spacecraft orbiting Mars, but there's no way we could get any images. So the press people at NASA were very distressed that the press people would be bored and go away. So they arranged little tours. So they put a bunch of us on buses and shipped us down to TRW, where we could look through the vacuum chamber at Pioneer 10, which was sitting all crumped up with the booms all kind of folded up like a praying mantis, you know, in distress, inside this glass port. And Eric and I came down the metal stairs, and we looked at each other and we said, good grief, this thing is going to go to Jupiter, make a left-hand turn, and be ejected from the solar system. It should carry a message. And that was the beginning of this archive parade that you have now so brilliantly, you know, illuminated with millions of pages and in almost inviolable materials that will last You know, I mean, the idea for humankind that we can create something that will last billions of years, that's mind-boggling. So talk about who might find this thing and why you're so proud now that it's standing upright there on the moon.
Yeah, I mean, we developed it to last for up to billions of years. What we've been told is that on the surface of the moon, there are micrometeorites that come at a certain angle, and depending on where something is, it might be pulverized in 50 million years, or it might not be. And, you know, in our case, the lander might protect us. It depends on the angle that the micrometeorites come at and, you know, to where we're positioned. But as we understand it, we're now sort of facing upwards, so essentially towards space and Earth, because the lander's on its side. Had it been upright, I'm not sure, you know, exactly where we would be facing. It would depend exactly its orientation, but we know that it is facing up now. And, you know, what we sent was 16 layers of nanofiche, which is a type of nickel nanotechnology, analog and digital storage media. It's very special patented technology containing, you know, enormous amounts of content, including the Wikipedia, you know, books, special data sets, curated archives, art, music, film, all kinds of stuff. So it's a very comprehensive kind of view of civilization as we know it today and the history that we are aware of. And it also includes an index to all known languages, and it has a primer in it that teaches about a million concepts using images that connect to five languages, and then from there to all known languages. And so it's quite carefully designed to teach what you need to know in order to understand it, and even to teach how to build a computer or at least all the necessary encodings and decodings that you would need to recover digital data that's etched at the lower levels of the archive as well. So there's analog images at nanoscale that you can see with a microscope, and then below them are actually digital layers. Anyway, it was designed for recipients in the distant future who might be similar to us. They might be our descendants. They might be some other species that evolves here or visits from somewhere else in the distant future. But we did this because there have been a lot of lost civilizations on Earth, as we all should probably be very well aware. And we decided, well, we could probably end that trend, at least this time, by making sure our civilization is never lost. And what we know of previous civilizations as well would also never be lost. So using these technologies, we've created this indestructible, potentially billion-year durability archive that now is on the moon as our first real offsite backup.
Well, let me stop you there, because to me, you succeeded with Bereshit. It doesn't matter that it's somewhere under the dirt.
That's true. It's true. It's just a little bit harder to find.
Yeah, so, but for you and me.
Right.
But not for a sophisticated extraterrestrial civilization.
That's true. And in fact, the Bereshit location might be more, I would say it has a beacon around it, in that there's this sort of debris crater that's non-natural that you can see. You know, the LRO easily can image that. You can see there's this non-natural sort of blast zone where it's sort of shattered into a million pieces, which is not, you know, typical of what you see. And so it's actually in some ways easier to spot from a distance than, you know, the Intuitive Machines location, which in the LRO is, you know, like a tiny little, like a grain of sand sitting on top of the moon.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's true. So we think of the Lunar Library, you know, as this 30 million plus page library that has stacks in two locations. You know, we've got sort of the north building.
No single point failure.
Right. We've got the north, sort of northern area and the southern
area.
Are
you going to have one on Viper, on the Griffin mission that NASA wants to send, looking at volatiles of the pole toward the end of the year?
We do have some small ones on some other missions, which I can't announce yet, but they are not really our missions. We're being carried by some other people, but it won't be the whole library.
Well, you were on Peregrine, which was Astrobotic,
right,
out of Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Their second big mission, Viper, which has been postponed at least once because of technical.
So we probably will fly again with them, but their whole schedule is, you know, sort of being reshipped.
Well, yeah, because look what happened to Peregrine.
Yeah, they're doing some analysis to try to make sure that doesn't happen again. But, you know, what I can say is that, you know, we're there in a couple places. You know, Peregrine coming back to the South Pacific. We may very well also be somewhere in the South Pacific because our archive is essentially, you know, more durable than a black box. Wouldn't melt.
You mean on a normal aircraft?
Yeah. It's a solid nickel. You know, it doesn't have any electronics in it, just solid nickel, sealed with epoxy, bolted into,
and what's,
you know, special
the melting,
metal glass.
What's the melting point of nickel? Do you know? Do you remember?
I have to look it up. Let's see. Melting point of nickel. It's pretty high. We calculated that it wouldn't have melted. Yeah, it's 2,651 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's pretty high.
Well, given that it was inside the spacecraft, right?
Well, it was actually, in the case of Arashit,
I mean Peregrine.
Well, in the case of Peregrine, yes, it was inside. In the case of Bereshit, it was just actually literally taped on with Kapton tape. In the case of Intuitive Machines, of course, we were bolted on. So we believe that in the case of Bereshit, it was just thrown away from the debris field when it hit.
Well, because the impact was essentially horizontal.
Yeah, and it wasn't really fastened to the lander other than with tape. So it would have easily just been released when that happened.
The moon's worst frisbee.
Yep, exactly. There's a frisbee. Yeah. And so in the case of Peregrine, yes, we were physically attached, you know, bolted on.
Were you on the outside or inside?
Actually, we were inside, as I recall.
See, this is why it's important.
Yeah.
Inside, you were inside the melting, you know.
We were protected for quite a bit of the reentry.
So you would have emerged from the pieces at an altitude and a velocity where, for nickel, the temperature would have been nothing, which means you're sitting at the bottom of the Pacific. There's an Arch Mission Foundation archive tonight off Indonesia.
And that was a 60 million page library, by the way.
Oh.
So somewhere in the South Pacific.
So now you've buried my book under the South Pacific in addition to putting it on the moon twice.
Right.
Yep. Oh, God.
Yeah. So, unfortunately, you had the misfortune of going on that tour long ago, and now here you are, memorialized.
Here I am. Yes. Okay. Hey, we are basically at the bottom of the hour. Can you hang around a couple of 3 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, good. Okay. Let me see. I have to figure out something I'm going to be doing here. What was I going to be doing? Oh, that's what I was going to be doing. Okay. Let me do that. My guest this morning, my first guest, is Nova Spivak. We're talking about now three archives he successfully sent into time. One to the moon with Bereshit, two to the moon with Odysseus, sitting kind of upright, and one in the bottom of the Earth's oceans off Australia and New Zealand, something like 3 miles down. You're on the other side of midnight. Talk about thinking big. We shall return.
Is in the hall. The moon and the cheeks are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor. And every day the paper boy brings more. And if the town breaks open many years too soon, and if there is no more on the hill, and if your head explodes with dust for bones too, I'll see you on the dark side of the moon.
theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
The lunatic is in my head. You raise the blade. You make the change. You rearrange me till I'm sane. You lock the door.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, the 2nd of March of 2024. We are successfully on the moon, again, this time kind of upright, with an archive, which was spearheaded and designed by a team led by my colleague and friend, Nova Spivak, who is with us tonight. So you have other plans for other archives, but you can't quite talk about them yet, right?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, some aren't announced yet. And some aren't finalized yet. You know, we have several, you know, more missions going to the moon. There's also some missions going to other points in the solar system. So I think we've got the moon fairly well covered at the moment. And although we will send some other things there, I think, you know, it'd probably be wise to put some things in other locations in the solar system as well.
Yes, with little beacons so they can be found.
Right. That's another interesting topic for how to make them recoverable, you know, in the blackness of space. One way to do that is to put them in obvious places like Lagrange points, where someone might actually look because there's other stuff there, and also just because it's a logical place to store something.
Well, once it's kind of like Hotel California. Once you put something at one of the two of the right Lagrange points, it will never leave.
Right. Right.
And that's like L4 and L5, not L1 right. or 2 or 3. They're unstable. But
right.
But 4 and 5, you can put them there and they'll be there. You know, it's like, where do we park? Oh, the L5 point. Yes, we'll be there.
Exactly. And that's probably a good place to look for other archives that might already be there, too.
Do we know anybody who's actually doing that?
No. It's been suggested. You know, people have thought that it's a decent place to look. It might also be an interesting place to look for, you know, interesting geological things which were kicked up, you know, from previous comet impacts. I mean, there's a lot of junk that might have collected there that could be interesting to study. But, you know, if I was going to leave a message, that would definitely be a place I would want to put one.
Mm.
So it seems like a reasonable place to look for one.
Mm. Well, all right, that gets into some very complex celestial mechanics, which we don't have time to get to tonight. The one thing I wanted to bring up, now I've sent you these pictures taken from orbit and during the landing by Odysseus, and your first question was, well, what am I looking at? Which is obviously very logical. If you did you take a look at my number three?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've seen all the images in the original form as well as yours. And the thing I don't really know the answer to is, you know, what do we know about the camera? And, you know, what are we really looking at in terms of what is in frame and what is not really a photograph, right?
There's well, I am assuming that these circles are basically a wide angle and the circle represents the horizon of the camera field of view.
But then you see weird stuff. Like, you know, in one of the images, you see this, you know, big kind of reddish circular lens flare around the sun, and it's inside and outside
exactly
that circle. So well, if it's outside the circle, what's it being, you know, are we saying the film is the film, the surface of the film is bigger than the lens? It's possible.
Well, it's a CCD chip.
Well, right, exactly. But
and that's so what I'm thinking we're looking at. And what we need to do is...
Does the CCD see more than the you know, the volume if, you know, of what's
all
inside the lens?
All we need is for Intuitive Machines to point us to how the cameras work. You know, the
right.
specs on
I mean,
the camera.
That would be, it would be worth knowing because it's kind of weird.
Yeah. Can you find this out?
No.
Why
I
not?
Mean, I think, you just have to see what they've published online. I don't have any access to that.
I have looked at that, and it's almost nothing. There's no technical data. They're being very secretive technically, which is weird because it's not like...
Wasn't this Eagle camera, or was it a different camera?
No. The Eagle cam, which is created by students at Embry-Riddle University, is a separate... ejectable module.
I see.
Kind of like
so. So this fisheye thing, we really don't know what.
There are several fisheye cameras on Odysseus' body, sticking out at various angles. There's also an experiment from Hawaii, the International Lunar Observatory Association, which it turns out was created by an old friend and colleague of mine, Steve Durst. I have sent Steve several emails. I've left messages on his machine. He has not gotten back to me during the press of the mission. I wasn't really surprised, but I'm hoping he'll get back to me in the coming days because he also had, as part of their wide field imager, their plan was to photograph in wide field the Milky Way from the surface of the moon to prove you literally can see and shoot stars if you design the right camera from the moon's surface. That was a big, you know, point of contention during Apollo, but film is nowhere near as incredibly sensitive, nor does it have the latitude of modern CCD technology. So what's interesting is that their camera is reporting the same thing that the Odysseus cameras are reporting. And we know that's a wide-angle lens, and we know the size of the field of view, 186 degrees. And what you do is you put it through these programs that convert back to a normal framing camera where you basically have a rectangular frame and everything's inside. And when you do that, you see the material inside the circle, which we're assuming is the edge of the lens, shows stunning geometry above the moon at all altitudes, 6 miles up, 1,500 feet up, and on the surface, which I have in my radio with pictures. I don't want to have you stay to look at that all night long. You're on the East Coast. But if you want to think about something, from this data, it seems to me, as we predicted, the glass over the poles is significantly thicker and more visible and denser, more of it remains, than over the equatorial zone where Apollo landed. And so your archive sitting there in Odysseus, Nova, is not only going to last however long the guys who say the moon is a vacuum is going to project, but it could last much, much longer because there's a glass dome overhead and it's going to keep the meteors from hitting you at the South Pole. So it could literally last till the end of life on Earth and the solar system. Literally.
That's actually a good point. Yeah. I mean, hopefully you're right. I mean, there's definitely some weird anomalies in these images. But, you know, before I could really come to a conclusion, I'd
I don't need you to come. All I need you to say is that it's fascinating. You want to know more, and then we'll work together behind the scenes to know more. And maybe by next weekend, we'll have some real answers, like the design of the cameras. I think they were purposely designed to be inscrutable by the ordinary person because it's part of a carefully controlled set of leaks. And I have a very good strategy for getting to the bottom of this, which we'll talk about later in the show. Before we let you go, I really hate to say those words, before you let you go, any final thoughts?
I'm interested to see, you know, what you figure out as you gather more data about the cameras, because there's just things about these images that are weird, in terms of stuff that's inside and outside this, what seems to be maybe the lens, but maybe it's not the lens. Maybe it's the dome itself. I mean, what are we really seeing on this top part of the image where you actually can see like a horizontal reflection on the surface of that? It's just weird. So, you know, I guess we have to know more. And also the pixelation of the sun, you know, how is that related to the CCD itself, or is that the dome or the glass or whatever you're, you know, hypothesizing is there? You know, it would definitely be good to know more about the.
And by specs. Next week, we're hoping we will. We'll maybe I'll get a response from Durst. You know,
yeah,
I mean, will, now that the mission is kind of on hiatus for 2 weeks till the sun rises again.
Right.
See, when I looked at the LRO image from orbit, because LRO was right, Johnny, on the spot. They got beautiful images from orbit showing the landscape before the landing and after the landing, and they've got a little blink thing going on there, so it goes back and forth. And I noticed the shadow immediately, and I said, wait a minute, that thing isn't lying down. It's almost standing straight up. And then we found from IM during the press conferences that it's about a 30-degree angle. I mean, think of it as a really dramatic leaning tower of Malapert A. But you're on top. But you're under a glass dome, so you're going to last much longer than you or I should probably even.
Hard to speculate, but yeah, hopefully, you know, hopefully it lasts a really long time. And of course, we'll send more in the future. Probably give it a little bit of time, just so there's a lot of updated information to send. But the plan of the ARC Mission Foundation is an ongoing distributed backup strategy. So, you know, you can look for more of these in the future and also on Earth as well.
Super. Okay, well, I'm going to let you good night because you're on the East Coast and you haven't had much sleep and there's too much partying and you succeeded.
Yeah.
You now got two of them on the moon, one of them under the Pacific, and more to come, right?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Super.
It was great to see you guys. Talk
okay.
soon.
Good night.
Bye.
Okay, before I bring on anybody else, I want to give you some context. If you look at my section of Radio with Pictures, remember item number 3 is the comparison of the close-up inside the circle of the Odysseus imagery showing magnified sun, which of course I believe is geometrically showing the dome. You know, the sun, even in clear space with a wide-angle lens, the sun doesn't look like that, okay? And then next to it, you can see this incredible glittering glass refractive cubical, you know, compartments in this arching dome, which is much more complex than an inverted salad bowl. So now you want to look at item number 4, number 5, and number 6, and you don't need to do it during the show. But beginning back in 2012, a poster named Crow777 began putting a series of videos taken through a telescope and a tracking mount and a very high-end video camera. And he began posting a series of videos that, frankly, when I looked at them, I said, oh, come on, it's got to be some kind of, you know, rude mistake. And I've now had, what, it's 2024, that's 12 years. I've looked. The other images, 6 and 7, are other observers with other telescopes, other cameras, who have all now shot the same exact damn absurdly impossible thing. There's something physically, dynamically, energetically going on around the moon. And the first poster, Crow777, found it and published this amazing video, which is my item number 4, beginning back in 2012. What it shows is shockwaves emanating from one part of the moon. On the first videos, it was the poles. On later videos, it's other places on the moon. And you see it as a double pulse. Not only do you see a dramatic refraction of a line of light racing at thousands and thousands of miles per hour from one pole to the other, which of course is half of the circumference of a sphere, 2,000 plus miles in diameter. So you can calculate to the, you know, foot per second how fast this stuff is moving, and it's moving really, really, really fast, thousands of miles per hour. It looks like, initially I thought to myself, wait a minute, that looks like an optical thingy. And then I look closer and I could see at the limb, which is the edge of the moon. Remember, that's where the dome, you can see it as a circumference all around the moon's round surface on a full moon image. The dome is just above the surface that you see. Well, in these videos, and again, pick any one and just start looking and looking and looking, you can see at the limb, at the edge of the moon, that this wave that travels from one pole to the other, twice, two waves, first one, then several seconds, then a second one. They're always in pairs, in twos. They race at this thousands of miles per hour from one pole to the other, from one pole to the antipodal pole, meaning the opposite part of the sphere. But at the edge of the moon, you can see them vertically, like you were looking horizontally at a horizon. And they are causing, whatever they are huge excursions, miles of excursions and angles of something physical refracting light, which is the dome. All around the moon, you can see at the limb, there's this physical shockwave that's moving thousands of miles per hour, which is thousands of feet per second. And you can see it now on three separate occasions, four separate occasions, three separate observers, the original guy, Kroll 77, and two others. And the Crow stuff I posted two separate versions of his analysis, which shows not only looking at the limb, but then straight down at the moon. And what you see is these waves pass, the surface features underneath the waves literally, optically move by tens of miles and then move back as the wave passes. In other words, even the original poster says it's like looking down through water. He didn't get there yet. He hasn't reached the idea that he's looking through a physical glass dome made of millions and millions and millions of separate panels, all put together, all hung together by some kind of connecting tissue, cables or, you know, connectors or whatever, that withstand the physical forces of a wave which can literally move the dome up and down by tens of miles in a vertical. I mean, it looks like, you know, somebody could surf on it. If you went from Hawaii up to the moon, you could literally surf under the crest of the wave. And it's astonishing. I'm going to put up a side-by-side comparison showing the height, showing all the measurements. But the fact that more than one person in the last 12 years has been videoing this stuff and posting it, just Google or DuckDuck or whatever, lunar wave anomalies. And you'll see now dozens of amateur astronomers with video systems, high-end systems, who all over the world have caught this stuff separately. No collusion, no collaboration. They're not, you know, doing this in a garage. It's really the moon, really video showing somebody testing, I believe, energetic properties of the dome. So then you go to item number 8, all right? And that is a composite, a two-image composite, showing on the left the rectified wide-angle image from Odysseus pitching over 1,500 feet. And then on the right, there is a just enhanced color-wise and contrast. And you can see the colors under this dome are identical to the wonderful colors that we saw from the Indian mission, Chandrasar number 3, the lander from India, where they showed us very limited views of the surface, but you saw exactly the same kind of pastel colors, which of course are caused in this model by light refracted through the dome. And when you get light through glass, you get prismatic effects. And when you blend the colors from a prism, you get all these wonderful magentas and cyans and whatever. So you don't get red, green, and blue. You also get, in addition, the mixing of the colors. And that's exactly what we're seeing on the left-hand side of item number 8. And then you go to 9, and then you'll see a magnification to the left of the sun with the crescent Earth there in the background. And then on the right is a magnified version of that. And look at all those tiers. not T-E-A-R-S, but T-I-E-R-S, meaning stacked layers. And notice that they are curving. On the left image, the wider angle image, and then the right close-up, you can see these tiers of geometry are curving, because when you use the algorithm to straighten out the wide angle view, you wind up correcting the geometric distortions of the surface and the sky. And so we can see the glass is arranged in levels, in decks, in tiers, and they are curved. Why are they curved? Because it's called a catenary curve, and it's under gravity. If you take and give your favorite girlfriend or your wife a new pendant, and it's on a chain or whatever, and she holds it out in front of her, you'll see that the weight, the pendant, causes the chain to follow a beautiful, smooth, curving arc called a catenary curve. Cables or extended horizontal surfaces sagging under gravity cause this curve to occur. And the first thing I found back way, way back when, decades ago on Apollo 10 imagery, is stuff about 9 miles above the moon, which seemed to be embedded in this glass grid, but it was sitting on a cable, so the cable was beautifully curving down and then up as a catenary curve, indicating that what we were seeing on the image, on the photo, was not a scratch, which of course the critics, oh, that's just scratches. No, scratches don't know about gravity. They don't know about catenary curves. They don't know about necklaces with pendants that weigh down the chain on both sides of your fingers, so they cause a smooth, beautiful curve. We're seeing that in this structure above the moon, in the so-called dome, which I think now is constructed by a circus tent technology, where you have certain distributed geometric points around the moon. Those are the tent poles, those are the supports. And the dome is hung on cabling, which we can see in close-up imagery from Apollo 10, which of course I saw 20, 30 years ago, and used as part of my effort with FurTech to create an optical model in the computer, very primitive computers back then, that would show us what we were seeing in terms of all the rectangular glass boxes that were hanging on these cables. So when a physical disturbance moves past them or through them, that's why you can get these extraordinary excursions of vertical, height, and the literal appearance of what looked like tsunami waves at the edge of the moon, at the limb, when these waves are passing, double waves several seconds apart by different observers. And there's a physical displacement. Well, if the cables are made of something like carbon fiber composite or buckyballs or nanotubes or graphene, any of these incredibly super strong carbon compounds that have now been created in the lab, you literally could create webbing, a cabling that would hold up such a structure, and any normal forces such as we're seeing in these videos could in fact be withstood by a strong but flexible architecture. Remember, that's why big trees don't come down in high winds. They bend back and forth because they are supple and they will move with the forces of the wind. If they didn't, they would snap. But by moving, you basically can distribute forces and remain below the force level that would destroy whatever, we're talking about. Skyscrapers on Earth, some of them in the more advanced technological cultures like Earth and like Japan and Los Angeles and I think even New York, now have buildings, skyscrapers designed to move, to sway, to literally move back and forth on wheels. So they do not try to resist an earthquake. They go with the flow and therefore they survive. Well, this dome, this extraordinary Arthur C. Clarke third law level structure, completely doming in the moon, denser over the poles because of, I think Andrew's going to try to tackle that one. you will see in his work that, in fact, physically, from several different perspectives, this thing, this structure is there. Item number 10. Take a look at item number 10. On the left is another processing of the wide-angle view that the intuitive machine sent back as their last image from a talking lander, kind of a farewell image, because it has the crescent Earth to the left of the strange geometric thingy that we think is the sun coming through the dome. But if you look on the right, I focused in on the reflection under the sun, and then below that, there's an even bigger enlargement. All that geometry is the glass in the dome, but the horizontal brilliant streaks are literally, as Greg thought last week when he was looking at an earlier image, it's the sun bouncing off angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, the horizontal ribbing, the mega structure supporting all the other glass, and you can literally see it looking like waves coming on shore at Malibu from a gently descending or setting sun or moon, and it's reflecting off the top of the ripples. Well, obviously, we're seeing ripples in this cable-supported structure that I've just outlined, and those are probably from these shock incidents that appear to be happening at irregular intervals, and I have no idea what's behind them, whether someone is doing it, whether they're testing from Earth the properties, the energetic properties of the dome, the so-called deep state, or is it ancient technology, which, as Andrew and I have discussed, might be on a timer, and now is the time when it's turning itself back on for whatever ancient purpose it was designed for. Like a hologram, whatever is left, however much material is left, it could all be connected through infinite cabling, you know, a matrix of mesh, of wires, so that even if part of it is still existing, it will turn on, it will light up. And part of our discussion last week was the synchronization of the David Copperfield, trick, making the moon disappear. Was that part of a larger project behind the scenes to basically fiddle more with the dome, and the fiddling would result in the moon disappearing optically, and you couldn't have that because that would raise too many questions. So in this political model, somebody said to Copperfield, hey, you've made various things disappear over the years. How'd you like a real big one? Make the moon disappear. We'll help you. You just can't tell anybody how we're really doing it. And at the end, they'll just say, David Copperfield is really, really, really amazing. I do not know the answer to that question. And when we come back, I'm going to bring Andrew on and the other members of our panel this morning, Holger and Ruggiero, and Ron is going to be with us. And we've even been joined tonight by Matthew Bailey. Matthew, of course, is our AI expert, colleague, and friend. We've done several shows. We're going to do another one, I think, next Sunday about this new lawsuit that Musk has taken out against ChatGPT and Sam Altman. Remember the huge soap opera there? They fired him. They paused. They thought. They rehired him. They kicked him upstairs. They got rid of the old board. They put a new. In other words, what's going on with Altman and ChatGPT? Well, we don't know, but we're going to find out. So you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. Don't touch that dial.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night here in the second hour of The Other Side of Midnight for March 2nd, 2024. And the name of the show, just in case you kind of have forgotten where we are, the name of the show is The David Copperfield Mystery. Well, actually, that's not totally what it is. Let me get it up here so you can kind of play along with me. The name of tonight's show is David Copperfield's Disappearing Moon. And we'll be talking about this a bit further on with Andrew in a few moments. And the oddest lunar landing mystery. Because we have all these amazing images now, absolutely showing exactly what since 1996, when I gave this presentation at the National Press Club, I said was there. The model, the glass, the ray tracing, the angles, it's all there. And all we need to do now is to sort out what are we seeing on these very weird pictures, which are like nothing else that has been published from space for decades. Normally, when you send a camera to another planet, you'd probably like to have the images available in a format that most people can recognize. Well, I'm getting pushback, but I'm thinking that there are several different levels of the Intuitive Machines Odysseus landing, one of which, a kind of a stealth mission, was to take unequivocal images of the dome, send them back to Earth, get them widely publicized in a form that most people don't recognize right away, so you could get past whoever doesn't want us to know what's above the moon. So, Andrew Curry, are you there? Come on down.
Yes, I am. Hi, Richard.
Hi there.
You're good.
Yeah. Okay. So when do you want to dig in here?
Well, I want to do one thing before we go forward. I want to congratulate NOVA and the Intuitive Machines team getting the Odysseus probe onto the moon. And I know we now know through reports that the machine is going to turn off. You should probably talk about that really briefly, Richard, that it's going to go to sleep in the cold.
Well, they already did that. That was Thursday. They turned it, they put it in a mode where if like the Japanese, they send a signal in 2 weeks when the sun's up again, it should answer. It should ping back. Because everybody has got this misimpression that it's the cold that does in the electronics. No, it's the differential cold. If I can cool something down slowly so every part of it doesn't contract and pull away solder joints and wires and, you know, little things on circuit boards and all that, then it doesn't matter how cold it gets. If you warm it up uniformly at the end of the process and then not turn it on until it's warm enough to think it's normal, it should come back to life, which is exactly what the Japanese probe did. It came back to life. Given the state of the art, given that everybody's using the same engineering, I am very confident that Odysseus has not sent to Earth its last image, and that the next set of images from all those cameras, they're going to be photographing the hell out of this dome from underneath, because maybe they don't know it's there. Maybe they just lucked out in getting down through it, and maybe they're going to use the next passes to confirm the bizarre, anomalous, too amazing to be believed data they're getting from the first passes. Maybe.
Yeah, and Richard, let's not forget Odysseus is protected by a goddess. That's Columbia. Got the logo right on the probe. And remember, that company developed some sort of I can't remember the details. We talked about this a couple weeks ago.
It's a multi-layered mylar-based fabric, which basically inhibits heat coming in, heat going out, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so there's lots of fail-safes there, so hopefully we can see something come up. But what I really wanted to talk about really right off the bat, Richard, is one of your listeners, he's great. He listens to the show, probably is right now. I didn't tell him I was going to do this. I won't mention his name. But he sort of, on the last show that I was on 2 weeks ago, he said he's sort of bouncing some emails back at me back and forth, and we were talking about the dome. And if you don't mind, I'd love to read just a little bit of the string. Okay, so we were kind of going back and forth, and he's going, it doesn't look too domey to me. anyways, so he said, here we go. We were talking about cameras. Actually, that's something I'd like to talk about later. So he sent me a really beautiful picture of the moon. He said, here you go. An 8-inch telescope. All you need is a telescope. Look carefully how clear the surface is. Excellent evidence against a glass dome. Gorgeous picture, by the way. I should have posted. And then I said, sure. But as Richard has stated repeatedly on the show, this side of the moon has the least glass remnants left due to micrometeorite exposure. Then he came back and said, I don't know how that would actually work. The moon rotates so all parts of the moon can get clobbered. I have attached a picture of the dark side of the moon. Again, not very domey. So I wanted to put together a little graphic. And if we go to my show items under me, where am I? I got to get myself organized here. Fast links to Andrew. And if we go to my number 3, and Richard, I'm going to let you take it from here. I call it the mechanics of lunar erosion. And this is just for people, you know, who just can't fathom this and, you know, in their head, like, well, how does this work, right? So if we kind of click my graphic that I created, you want to take it from here, Richard?
Okay. If you look at Andrew's graphic, which is 3, the top one is the moon, and the fuzzy stuff you're seeing is the side facing the Earth now. Item number 2, figure B, is the moon with stuff built on it, kind of above it, kind of this, impressionistic sketch version of structure, a dome above the moon we see. And then in item number 3, on the same graphic, the moon is moving to the left. The meteorites, most of the micro stuff is basically determined by the orbit motion of the moon. So if the moon is moving left, the side on the left, the front, in terms of orbit, should get most of the erosion. The side on the back, on the right side, in number 3, or figure C, should get the least erosion. And at the poles, as you can see, if you draw those horizontal lines, as you get more and more to the pole, a surface which is 90 degrees to the incoming meteors, like they're coming down directly overhead, if you're under the arrow on figure C on the left, the meteors are coming straight down, but at the poles, they're coming sideways, which means they have to come through an awful lot of dome sideways, mass, material, knock it out of the way, destroy it, blow it away, have it leave as shrapnel, as high-speed ejecta. So the poles and the side away from the orbit are going to be the most protected in this scenario. So by landing not at the equator where Apollo landed, where the dome is now almost gone, totally, totally gone, by landing at the poles or landing on the far side like the Chinese did, you are in danger of encountering big globs of glass on your way down. And we know with the Japanese, they must have hit something because they knocked off an engine. So they literally, you can see it in the photographs, lying next to the lander on their images descending. And so they then landed too hard, they rolled, and they came to rest upside down. Fortunately, the electronics inside doesn't care. If an antenna happened to be aimed toward the Earth, that didn't care. And so they were able to get data for like 2 or 3 days in their geometry. They put it to bed. It came back on, and the Japanese are interacting with their slim lander for a second lunar day. The same thing should probably happen to Odysseus, given again that the electronics are basically the same. Now, here's where things get a little complicated. If my scenario is correct, Andrew, then all the material on the left-hand side of your schematic moon, that should be basically whittled away, right? And yet I'm saying it's the side facing the Earth, right?
Yeah.
So how does that work?
Well, you tell us.
Because the moon is rotated. From the time the dome was built till the time that we're looking at it now, the moon has rotated 90 degrees. So the side that we see is the side facing Earth. It used to be facing front. It was facing left. That's why 66 million years ago, when the fourth planet was destroyed, erupted, exploded, a la Tom Van Flandren's work, and all this debris went careening across the entire solar system. So if you have an object which is basically orbiting the Earth, and you add its velocity orbiting the Earth to the Earth's velocity orbiting the Sun, every time it's in that position behind the Earth with the Sun on the other side, it's moving fastest relative to the meteor stream, so that side will be whittled away, and then a major impact occurred sometime later, which rotated the moon 90 degrees. So the side that used to be facing always the orbit front, facing Earth, so we're looking at a primeval relic of an ancient time when our side, the near side, was facing the left-hand side and therefore getting almost extinguished by erosion. And that's why it's the thinnest, why it's the safest to descend through, why we've had more successful missions. And as explorers and new robots have tried to land in other places, because they don't know the dome is there, at least that's our assumption, they do not design for it, and they hit a piece, or their landing system, which is based on lasers, is so confused by the multiple glass reflections coming down through the dome, particularly at the poles or on the far side, that the odds of their succeeding is much, much less. And that's why 50% of all the modern landers have crashed. And the two most recent ones that are successful are kind of like, not really. You can walk away, you can keep your instruments going, but you'd never put that one in the history books for a successful three-point or six-point landing with nothing happening afterwards, because something happened on the way down. Is that enough?
Yeah, well, Richard, so this is, if the face of the moon facing us now is the least glassed.
Yep.
You know, it's like, yep. It's and we could have, you know, they keep saying, I keep hearing, it was another one of your listeners, he's great, he's also a Facebook friend, and he was really annoyed, actually, with little production they had when Odysseus was landing. He said, this is so disingenuous, it's like a big info commercial, and he said, Andrew, you got to watch this. So I started watching it, because I didn't see it live. And Richard, it was almost like a color man. It was almost like watching a sports broadcast. There was like a color man who works for NASA, and there was a play-by-play guy from Intuitive Machines, and then over to you for an interview with this person. And it was like, okay, now, and it was a very strange production, and he's right. It had this sort of weird commercial broadcast feeling to it, and it I don't know, but that was one other piece. But if these probes, like whether it's India, Japan, the Americans now, if they wanted to be safe, oh yeah, that was my point. They keep saying, especially on that info commercial, how hard it is to land on the moon. You mentioned this earlier in the show.
Yeah.
And we heard this. Well, I didn't hear it because I was, you know, really tiny. But when Kennedy said it. He said, you know, we do the things that are hard. You know, and it's like they're repeating this. It's like,
we didn't know how to do any of this stuff. And
exactly.
Now we've had half a century. Look at the technological progress in ocean liners in half a century, from the height of the golden age in the 50s of people going to and from just Europe. Now We're on floating cities that are, you know, 1,000 feet long and several hundred feet high, and nothing but cruise passengers, and they're not going anywhere. They're going on a place that's moving to another place because they want to be on the moving place. The same thing has happened with airliners. We've actually had supersonic transport, the Concorde, from the time of the Wright brothers to the present. The moon technology for landing not only appears to have stood still, it appears to have gone backwards. We're dumber,
well,
we're stupider than this. And of course, the critics say, well, that just means that the modern guys can't do it because the original guys didn't do it. They were lying to us. We never went to the moon. Another big lie. No, we know we went to the moon because all the images show the dome. And if we never went to the moon, how could NASA public fake images of a dome that doesn't exist because it never went? In other words, it's a circular logic that falls apart. No, the technology now compared to 50 years ago, change the location, change the, you know, environmental problems of a dome that's in much better condition over the poles or on the far side. And I think that accounts easily for the 50% failure rate of the current crop of people trying to land on the moon.
Right, which gets to my second point, besides it's so hard, is they are purposely testing those borderlines, those limits, that outer edge. They're not being safe. I mean, that's pretty obvious now that they're tempting fate. And somebody, either they don't have the data to be able to negotiate around this dome, or somebody's putting them out there and baiting them that you figure it out for yourself. And, you know, because, right, Richard, if we just landed in the safe, nothing's safe, but in the more, well, in the places that are tried and true, like close to where Apollo landed and these kinds of things. So they are teasing the edges. They're biting on, they're nibbling on the edges, and they're, you know, they're like my son's little Russian dwarf hamster. You know, she skirts, he puts her out on ledges, and I'm like, what are you doing? And but she has like this amazing balance, right? Well, I mean, I wish she would stop doing that. I didn't say that on air, did I? But he's right there to hold her.
Yes,
but, you know, she's
you
right
did.
Well, she's right on the edge, and he's right there with his hands. But she's got this negotiating power to move very quickly along these you know, these narrow tracks. So it feels to me like either they're being, because I know that we could look at the Indian thing and say, well, you know, we're looking for water because then we can find fuel and we can find, you know, living components to be able to build on the moon. I get it, but I don't believe every single probe is worried about looking for water. I mean, from Nova's description, it sounds like, hey, we're just trying to get there. It's like a hiking trip. We're just trying to get to the top of the mountain. So yeah, they're jumping on these edges, these spots where it's going to be more adventuresome, whether they know it or not. And this is the pattern we continue to see. Well, that's what I think, at least.
See, what I don't understand is, why do people, engineers, trying to do this, why are they constantly trying to reinvent the wheel?
Well,
Richard, see, normally, if you got an incredible success for the first time with a technology that's 50 years old, you'd want to look at, what did they do? Why did they succeed? How are they knowledgeable and we aren't? Well, one thing they did is they didn't use lasers. Glass and lasers do not mix. They used something called S-band radar. Now, back in the 60s, S-band radar, you literally had what are called traveling wave, you had vacuum tubes. You created high energy radio waves with a vacuum tube and magnets and electrons in a calibrated flow. Vacuum tubes are fragile. If you land too hard on a surface with a vacuum tube, what happens? It breaks, and then you can't use it because the vacuum's gone. So they were using this archaic technology, but they succeeded with Surveyor 5 out of 7 times. Now, because it's 2024, you don't have to use big, complex, power-hungry electronics to create radio waves of the same frequency that Surveyor used. You can have what's called a solid-state transmitter, which, like lasers, is one-tenth the power, one-hundredth the weight, you know, one-tenth of the volume. In other words, if they decided to go with radio waves, good old radar, there are technologies now, solid-state, that can create radio transmitters which are as efficient as lasers. But we know the radio waves don't get caught in the dome. They bounce off the surface. Therefore, our guys landed, and the current crop is not landing. And you'd think their engineers would go, well, there's got to be a factor here we're not accounting for. Unless the existence of the dome is the big secret that nobody ever intends to tell us about. Even if they are taking pictures and they're leaking the existence of this thing left, right, up, down, not only by one set of cameras, but by all the cameras on board are showing us various aspects of this unknown, unacknowledged, unadmitted, major, huge feature of the moon we think we know.
Well, Richard, on the note of cameras, and I do want to step aside so because we got a big crew here. I was having this conversation with Michael, one of your listeners, and I was saying, you know, and we heard it again with Nova, sort of, and even Joseph from last week, like we're looking at this giant, I guess it's a fisheye camera, and I'm thinking, is this the best we can do? You know, talk about, like you said, advancements in ships, cruises, planes, et cetera, computers. And, you know, doorbell cameras show better images sometimes than some of the stuff that we're seeing from the moon. It's like, is it that difficult? Is it that weighty to put, you know, like cameras all over the space probes? I don't understand that. That's the part and so we get these limited, limited perspective. It's almost like when we do filming, like in TV and commercials and movies, is, you know, the eye is seeing the Promethean arch, right? We're seeing the stage, and everything behind that would be, you know, if we opened it up, the camera aperture, you'd see like guys and women and everybody standing on the side holding microphones and everything. So it's a very narrow alley of view. And I don't understand why none of these probes can't seem to give us multiple views from different cameras all at the same time. I mean, they do it well with the landers on Mars. Why can't we do it on the moon?
Given the fact that the moon is only, you know, a couple of seconds away, and the bandwidth and the signal strength and all that, I mean, it's right next door. It's just 240,000 miles away. That are sending us data from New Horizons, which is beyond Pluto, which is four billion miles away, and the signal strength goes down as the inverse square of the distance. So you just do the numbers on an envelope. There's no reason why we shouldn't have multiple live video of these landings, and all they do is show us these stupid animations because they're hiding the real moon. They're hiding it. Okay, let me bring on Ruggiero. Ruggiero Kahlo is a podiatrist. He also is a brilliant medical illustrator. He does artwork in a very different style than Andrew, but he sees things. So let's go to Ruggiero, who has gotten up at the crack of dawn in Britain to basically be with us to show us some of the things that he's been seeing. So let's start with the moon, Ruggiero, okay?
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. Have you had your tea?
Good morning, everyone.
Have you had your tea?
I haven't had my tea.
Oh.
I need to get myself a coffee, but that can wait because we've got more important things to do and discuss. So far away, Richard, what would you
well,
like
to Well, let's start with the moon
because
you've got some images up there from Io and you have some other images of the moon from Earth. But let's start with this mission. I've been sending you these images from the cameras on board the mission. What is your response to what you're seeing?
Right, I need to put this together somehow I can frame it correctly. The first thing I'd like to highlight is do you remember on the email I sent you this week with my point of confusion, which is a big question really, as to why are we seeing normal color on some photographs? And others, we're seeing extra colors come out. So if I take people through the journey of my imagery, and I looked at, I'll start with number 12 and then on to 13.
Right.
So I went on both the NASA and the Intuitive Machines websites, and What I did was I screenshotted them both. And on image 12, you'll just see a normal color of the moon.
Well, image 12 was released by Intuitive Machines. They went into lunar orbit. Mm-hmm. There was all kinds of soap opera in the background behind this picture we didn't know about when we got the picture. And it looks like a normal lander orbiting the moon. The moon is gray in the back. The lander has gold mylar. It's got red cabling. It's got all the normal stuff. But if you increase the saturation, you're saying that the moon turns from gray to color. The reason that is because the color is there. It's not, you're not creating it. You're simply turning up the saturation, meaning you're turning up the color values. And you're not magically making it appear out of nowhere. It's there. It's subtle. It's pastels. And when you enhance the image by turning up the color, you see both the lander colors, which are obviously vibrant because it's a brand new machine. And then you see this ancient, you know, refraction through the glass in my model around the dome, which is why the moon, when you increase the color, it becomes colorful, because the colors are there, but they're just so subtle because the glass is so thin now. It does not effectively refract like a prism chandelier in your dining room, the primary colors of the rainbow and or the various colors you get when you mix those primary colors. But given that with these cameras, you can simply increase the saturation and bingo, the color is there. That's how I know that they're not doing much with the image other than suppressing the colors of the moon. Because remember, the moon's supposed to be dead and gray, nothing going on but vacuum and craters and radiation. So all these missions are not showing us the full spectrum, pun intended, of what we're looking at until you take it into a program on Earth, increase the saturation, and then bingo, the color from the dome is readily visible.
Yeah, so what for the scientific method, what I did is when I did my screenshots, because I was using Apple Mac, a MacBook Air, and I managed to screenshot in the details of the program on both the before and the after. So that would be image 12 and image 13. You can see exactly how much I changed, enhanced, manipulated the photo to bring out the color in the level of saturation and a few other tweaks.
Yeah, and we're getting down to the bottom of the hour, so we've got about 30 seconds here.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, and then I'll jump onto number 15, and that was strangely on the spread on Intuitive Machines. You got about 5 images. I think I clicked on the middle one, and I tried to change that one, and I can't. The background just stays gray. And that was
Because that's not a real picture. My analysis said that's a composite. That's a picture that they released. They made up. It's not an actual image. It's been literally composited by Intuitive Machines because they did not want us to see what's on the real moon underneath the spacecraft. So they substituted what we think of as the moon. They're not telling us the truth. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to be able to show you exactly how they did it. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
The other side of midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night. On the David Copperfield Disappearing Moon and the Lunar Mysteries of the Odysseus Space Mission show, where we're talking with various participants in the Enterprise mission team. Ruggiero is on right now. He is a podiatrist from England. He does sketches, brilliant sketches of both medical and non-medical material. And he's asked this basic question, why, when you change the saturation on current images, do you get color on some images, and it just remains stubbornly black and white on others? And what my assessment is of those images, you tried to bring up the color, that's not the real moon. That's a synthetic moon inserted in those shots because they can't show us the real moon. The real moon below this spacecraft covered with junk. And I've been working on a way of revealing the real surface from the descending lander. And I've got something, but I'm not quite ready for prime time. I don't want to put it out there because everything you put on the internet lives forever. So we're trying to be very, very cautious and careful. But it looks to me like, you know, Odysseus was designed from the get-go as a stealth mission, as a mission which would post imagery without comment, letting everybody kind of figure out what they're looking at. And if you actually do the homework yourself, you find that they're not giving us everything, because if they did, it would be a fait accompli, and obviously they're trying to fly under the radar by posting data that others can process and explain, but they are not put in the hot seat to explain it themselves. And when we get toward the end of the program, I'm going to suggest something that might change this political situation for the better. Did I cover enough of what I think is going on so you get the idea? Whoops.
Yeah, we're getting there. I just want to say tonight's show is just utterly fascinating. And I think I've looked through everybody's data briefly, and there's just so much to get through and to cover. And everything I put on tonight, I've done my best to make utterly relevant to this evening's show. And some of the stuff might look quite bizarre. Have I got time? Can I jump onto image
five? Well, I want to bring in others. I want to talk about the moon. Then we'll come back to the other things you've posted.
Okay.
Because we may not have time. We have a lot of people, and Matthew had something really important to add, and I wanted to bring him into the conversation because, frankly, where this is going, where I think this can be resolved, is if we turn to AI. AI is the new authority figures, where when AI looks at something and it says something, people tend to believe, oh, it's an artificial intelligence, therefore, oh, it's got to be right. Well, no, you don't deal with AI like any other authority figure. You look at the data and you see if its analysis corresponds and confirms your independent analysis, and that's, of course, the way we should focus on this. I want to bring on Holger Eisenberg. Holger is a computer expert. He's living in the Bay Area in California. He used to live in Germany way back when. He caught my attention because after the Viking landings back in 1976 and the color imagery from Mars, it was Holger very courageously and resolutely went about showing technically that the colors represented from NASA's mission Viking to Mars was not accurate. The skies are not blood red. There are blue skies on Mars, which opens up a whole can of worms about atmospheres and densities, and molecular scattering and all that. So Holger, what's your analysis of the current Odysseus mission to the moon?
Oh, first I was thinking when following LISA landing was communication outage. It was the first topic coming up. Because there was nothing shown. They landed. That was shown live on their video stream. And then nothing. Communication outage. And we had to wait, I guess, one day to see the first image, photo show on the surface. That was a bit surprising. And of course, as a, with a private company mission, they cannot reveal everything, as, because they cannot reveal all the technology. It's understandable. But
let me stop you there. The only thing that Intuitive Machines develop that's proprietary is the cryogenic oxygen, methane, liquid methane engine. That's their proprietary development. The rest of the technology, they simply bought off the open market. So they can tell us why these cameras have these weird fisheye lenses and what they're doing to produce imagery inside the lens and outside the lens, because as I was saying to Nova off the air before, I think it's done deliberately to confuse people. Because their mandate is to show us what's there, but like Emily Dickinson, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Unless they come out with an official press release describing the dome elements that are right there in the pictures. Multiple pictures, every picture they released, except the ones in transit between Earth and Moon. Nobody is going to believe what we're talking about tonight. Unless we bring in the ultimate authority figure politically of AI, and that's the conversation we're going to have with Matthew very shortly. So back to your potential. The data is there. They're just not telling us what it is they're finding.
And we had to, if I remember correctly, we had to wait more than one day for the first image in the second press conference, And when comparing that with, for example, the first,
yeah, and every day you wait,
landing on the moon in 1966, 35 minutes after landing, the first image appeared live on TV, black and white, but live on TV, 35 minutes after landing with Surveyor 1. And even with Apollo, the fastest image delivery with Apollo was a bit about 5 hours. So still faster than 1 day or 2 days with the current mission.
Well, this is another trend curve which is going in the wrong direction. 50 years ago, we had live transmission of television from the moon. Live in the sense that when the astronauts, after 5 hours, got out, they turned on the camera and all their moonwalks and all that was sent live. Back in 1969, with a black and white Westinghouse extraordinarily limited bandwidth TV camera. Now we have stunning state-of-the-art electronics, miniaturized cameras, color, sensitivity, greater bandwidth, greater power capability, and we're not seeing anything live. What's wrong with this picture?
And not to forget, it was the NASA Commercial Lunar Payload Service mission. So NASA commissioned them to deliver a payload commercially to the moon. And if I, on the Earth, commission payload delivery with a postage service, for example, for packages, I get an immediate delivery verification picture. A second, it lands on my doorstep from Amazon. That is standard industry for package delivery. Why not on the moon? Only 3 seconds further away.
Well, the obvious answer, I think, is they're being, you know, very careful to censor things that would be intuitively, pun intended, obvious as to what they're viewing, what they're photographing, what somebody's trying to show us. There's wheels within wheels within wheels. So take us through this very interesting mission, which almost failed, didn't, sent back.
Richard?
Yeah, go ahead. Is this Ron?
Yeah.
Ron Gerbron. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm trying not to waste your time. Let me throw an asterisk in here on the bit about them being careful what they release. Being an old guy, I remember when it was happening, and the vast majority of the pictures taken during the Apollo program on the moon. Didn't show up for a year and a half. They started dribbling them out.
No. You're talking the film. Hang on, Ron. We're Holger and I are talking about live television, not the film. The film had to be brought back to Earth, processed in the laboratory in Houston by Dick Underwood, who was head of the photo lab, and then the PR people released to the print magazines. Remember, totally different era. No internet, no ability to see it in your living room. All you could see was on television, and everybody was satisfied with a few pictures, but the television came down live. Now we know from the Chinese, they gave us live video of their landings, and no Western missions, and I consider the Japanese a Western mission, have given us anything close. The Indians didn't give us any live data from the moon. It's all carefully censored behind animations because they don't dare show us what is really there.
Well, of course. I'm familiar with the difference between film and video. I'm just saying that they take their own sweet time about releasing this stuff. And nowadays, there's no point in trying because of social media and everything else. Somebody in the lab's going to tweet out the pictures they're trying to hide. So it's helped a little.
Well, I don't think we have any unauthorized leaks. Everything which we're looking at has been officially released. I only got one image from a member of my audience who's kind of connected that I think was a leak. And the only reason I know that is because it's the best highest resolution version of the image they sent with the little crescent Earth. And that's the one that shows this stunning crystalline detail, the cubical glass boxes of the dome in incredible resolution. And that one came out not officially, but from an unofficial source, but it's obviously identical to the one that's released. It's just of much better quality. So I've got one confirmed leak, a lot of public data, which if you understand what you're looking at, the public data is more than enough to reach the conclusion there is a dome over the moon, thicker over the poles as we predicted, and they were really lucky to get down. And the fact that they crashed, kind of, is because the landing systems are not designed to land safely through glass. It's obvious. That will obviously now be corrected because they know what's there because it's on their own data. Holger, let's go back to you.
There was also a plan to be published soon. What I heard is because the data was received, the narrow angle ILOX image, so the second camera, the narrow angle, more telescope-like camera, which they apparently received already and plan to publish, I heard, in the public press conference. But it's understandable that they hold it back.
Wait, do you know when the second lunar telescope image will be released? The narrow angle?
I don't know when, but they said they received the image, and the ILOX is a non-profit founded.
Yeah, that's the one run by my old friend Stephen Durst in Hawaii.
Apparently, they are currently holding an auction to sell the first image, so that might be understandable to get some funding via the publication of the second high-resolution image. That might be the reason to delay it.
Andrew,
but also
free enterprise is raising its ugly head.
Yeah, but outside of the live television or quickly released stand image, still images, why not sending a live audio ping transmission or so to the public? Because the only verification we received when following the landing live was in the official live stream, they said they landed, but didn't show any data for that. And the only verification we had was from independent radio observatories, which received the radio signal, and they could establish then by the change in the radio signal frequency that actually the landing occurred, a soft landing, because the signal changed abruptly and then continued steadily. That means it was still sending. And that was then on Twitter, for example, confirmed by a few private radio astronomy stations, like the one in Germany, in Bochum, I had on my Twitter feed in item 3, where they directly showed the live stream from their antenna from the radio, from the amateur radio team there in the radio observatory in Bochum. And they were quite experienced because they also received the data from the radio, live radio audio from Apollo, and also much earlier from Sputnik, the first station which received in public the data from Sputnik in 57. And they had a live stream there, so that was some independent confirmation about a landing, but no further other data. It was a bit disappointing.
Well, let me ask you a kind of a leading question. Given this radical departure between the early missions where we knew nothing, so there was nothing to hide, and now these missions where presumably after 50 years, there's been a lot of background analysis of what's around the moon, my model, et cetera, et cetera. It's being confirmed by Odysseus. It's being confirmed by Odysseus, and yet they're not saying a thing. So your assumption is the censorship is intervening because why?
I don't know, but I haven't thought about that.
Well, wildly speculate. What's the obvious reason, if you're not telling your audience the truth like you did 50 years before? The obvious reason is you're covering up something, right?
Yeah, I was thinking or having some speculation about the switch of the landing system, because the company landing system, the LIDAR, was unfunctional officially, or it was published that they forgot the enabling switch to activate in the cabling. But it's from my point a highly speculative. Maybe could be that that NASA knew some technical detail. It's purely speculation from my point that they knew some technical detail which is important to get it running. Detail might not be known by the companies yet. And they knew that the LIDAR was not working.
See, one of the weird things about this private corporation to the moon business is that Altimus, who's the head of the company, he said forthrightly they're going to share all their technical details with Astrobotic, which is developing the Viper mission that was supposed to be launched sometime toward the end of the year, which is part of Artemis to look for volatiles. That's what the V in Viper stands for, looking for volatiles like water and methane and other frozen gases for a lunar base. So they're talking about sharing the technology. So then again, you wonder, well, why are all these time delays in giving us live data? Was it because they couldn't send the data live downstream? If I'm a private corporation and I'm trying to get investors to be part of a successful enterprise, pun intended, the biggest thing now with everybody with smartphones and social media is images. You can send images of anything anywhere in the world from anybody doing anything. You'd think a live landing on the moon, you'd have live television to show every exquisite detail of an unprecedented commercial feat, and yet it's more censored than the damn Chinese missions. What's wrong with this picture?
Could be that some technology is needed, which is not that much known. Also, there's no visual light space telescope except for the Hubble Space Telescope outside Earth. And this ILO-X telescope would be the second only visual light telescope outside of Earth operating. And we haven't seen it yet operating because we have only seen the surface images it took. But we haven't seen the space images it took from the sky yet.
Nope.
And that only the Hubble Space Telescope showed it in visual light. So we had a UV telescope in space, infrared telescopes, but only the Hubble is a visual light telescope in space. The Chinese is soon coming in a few weeks or months even. That will be the second or third then.
All right, tell you what, let me move to Greg Ahrens, who is one of our experts. I've kind of roped him into this. Greg is an Air Force veteran. He does imaging. He does mathematics. He looked at the Norway spiral with me in great detail. He's been looking at the Barry 1 spacecraft, which, by the way, is still ascending in orbit around the Earth, where they're claiming they can't talk to it. The radios have gone silent. They can't communicate. They didn't turn on the engine, and yet it's rising in its orbit. We'll talk about that probably next week. Greg, you wanted to say some things about your observations vis-a-vis the Odysseus mission. What has been your conclusion?
Well, it looks to me like they found the dome.
Finally, somebody who can look at a picture and knows what they're seeing.
Well, I saw that one with the during their press conference. I was listening to it on a phone and just glance at the teeny picture. And when they flashed that on, I said, "Wait, that looks like the dome." So then I had to get a better picture of it, you know, on a regular computer and see what was going on. But now, on my items, on number two, hang on.
Let's describe to folks how they get there. You go to the other side of midnight.com. All right. You want to go to the banner. Click on the banner on the other side of midnight.com, which says Copperfield's Disappearing Moon and the Odysseus Lunar Landing Mystery for March 2nd. Click on the banner. That will take you to the guest page. You will see under the guest page fast links to items. The banner on the guest page, click on Greg. That takes us to his section. So go for it.
Okay. The reason I put number two up, it's also taken with that wide-angle lens or fisheye.
Right, in Earth orbit before they left.
And they're in Earth orbit, the second stage or third stage, whatever, the upper stage.
It's the second stage of the Falcon 9. You can see it above the Earth behind them.
Is floating behind them. And the sun, now this is the only picture they took before they got to the moon that shows the sun in the picture. And so, but there is some, you know, there's some lens flare and stuff in it, and there's also the ring on the outer edge of the picture, but the sun is away from the ring. Where on the picture from the Schomburger crater,
right,
the sun was kind of split by the ring, and it looked like it was, you know, cut in half and was reflection.
Right.
So that was I put this one up so people could compare what the sun looks like before.
See,
to get
one
to
of
the
my
moon.
Missions for this week is to get to the mechanics of these cameras. Because unlike NASA and unlike their press kit, where they were really, you know, Intuitive Machines really produced in a PDF color form something approaching an old-fashioned NASA press kit. I remember I used to be out in Florida with Cronkite at the pool, and we both had these huge notebooks, and we'd have hundreds of pages, every detail. You wanted to know something about the circuitry in the S4B for the IMU? Those are acronyms. It was in this notebook. You wanted to know something about the film type and the shutter speed for the cameras on the crew? It was in this notebook. Everything, kind of like the old Carson line, everything you ever wanted to know about the Apollo mission you were covering was in these stupid, big, damn, multi-pound notebooks, which our staff made up. Now, you want a detail on the camera. You look and you look and you look. We're in the information age. Everything is on the internet. You can't find a damn thing about these cameras. Why not? Because they don't want us to know how they're making up the pictures. So as Nova said, well, I can't really reach a conclusion because I don't know what I'm seeing because I don't know how the cameras work, which is a very potentially grounded scientific reaction. I think by design, the company is obscuring under their commercial status, the fact that they've got $118 million of our money, taxpayer money. When you go to the moon all by yourself and you have your own network, you can play all kinds of cute games. But if you're functioning under a NASA contract where half the mission cost is being supported by the American taxpayer, under the NASA charter, the American taxpayer should have full technical knowledge of what they're seeing, how they're seeing it, how it's processed, what conclusions they should draw based on the limitations of the cameras. In other words, all the critical scientific data that we need to make a scientific analysis is carefully being withheld and censored, and it's not right under the charter.
Right. Yeah. It's obscured anyway. At least now, if you look at my number three item, which I just had Concia put up tonight, there is information about the ILOX instrument.
Okay. This is a lunar telescope, not the Odyssey camera.
It's two.
Yeah. They're corporate packages from the International Lunar Astronomy Association, run by my friend and colleague Steve Durst out of Hawaii. It's a camera package with a wide and narrow angle camera totally separate from the cameras from Intuitive Machines on the spacecraft itself, right?
Well, I'm not sure. I think the wide angle, the wide field of view imager is the one that we've been looking at with the 186 degree.
Yeah, they released one image from Thursday, three days ago. And it looks like it's either the lens is covered with sand or dust or dirt, or there's something in the sky that was photographed by the camera, which they're not explaining. Andrew and I went over it kind of carefully the other night. When you look at it, what do you think you see?
I'm not sure which one. I saw something on their page that said there was possibly a crack in the...
Well, that's that little bright streak at the bottom of, at the edge where the circle. But they have the same circular horizon, like a wide-angle 186-degree lens that the spacecraft cameras have. Remember, two different institutions, two different sets of camera, but they're both showing us the same thing overhead. It's just interpreting the wide-field imager. We don't know because they didn't reveal any information. Did they get a lot of dust on the lens? Of course, if your lens has not got a dust cover, why would you put a dust cover on a lunar lander? Well, on this mission, remember, they had four cameras on the legs designed to photograph the effects of the dust kicked up by the engine, right?
Right.
Well, you would assume if you're sending optics to the moon and you know there's a dust problem, you will have a mechanical design where the cameras are carefully protected from the dust till the engine is turned off. And the dust blows away.
Right.
And then you unveil the cameras, either a lens cover, a lens cap, basically it's a mechanical round shutter which has spokes which unfurl it like an iris in your eye.
Right.
No. Well, all of that would protect
the diaphragm.
Say again?
The diaphragm.
Yeah, well,
it's
basically the gadget behind the diaphragm, which shows you whether it's open or closed. You know, you need some kind of shutter to take a picture. But if you don't have your camera encased in something where the dust can't stick to it after landing, I mean, that's what it looks like has happened to the ILO cameras. They're hopelessly dust covered. Because they weren't covered during the landing, which, of course, they knew there was going to be dust because they had four cameras to photograph the dust from the landing. So the left hand may not have talked to the right hand. There may be some engineering refinements required before the next mission from this company. And I have no idea what the future plans of ILO are, the International Lunar Observatory, with these two cameras mounted at the top of the body of the spacecraft, because A, it's tipped over 30 degrees, which means their carefully calculated fields of view of the sky are now, you know, trash. They're not useful. But they got something and they published it, but they didn't publish any understanding of what we're seeing in the image. They just published the image. It's so Emily Dickinson.
Right. And I think I put number four as the link to the website for the ILO organization in Hawaii, and it has, that's where I got the specifications for the in the left sidebar under the 23 February article.
Yeah, and we are up against the top of the hour, so let's hold it there. My guest this morning, Too Numerous to Mention, just go to the website and take a look. You'll see all their names, you'll see their backgrounds, why they're part of this conversation. You're on the other side of midnight. It is midnight here in the Land of Enchantment, and soon we'll be on the other side. Stay tuned.
The Other Side of Midnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoglund and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on the other side of midnight here on the Land of Enchantment from the New Mexican deserts in northern New Mexico, just slightly north of where the first atomic bomb was detonated back in 1945. Our next guest in the lineup tonight is someone that I really wanted to have give us his input, because I think ultimately we're going to have to go to the what I will call the AI solution. I don't think our culture anymore is going to believe human beings, but based on what I've seen in the field, if an AI is submitted with these pictures and the appropriate background of the technology, the camera angles, the mechanisms, the engineering, the optical trains, the shutter speeds, power, all that stuff comes out with some kind of analysis as to what is there, my feeling is politically that people are more likely than not willing, because they're being inculcated, to believe that if an AI looks at something, it's going to give you the truth. Matthew Bailey, come on down. What do you think?
Good evening, Richard.
Good evening. So what are your thoughts when you look at these images and thoughts in general? Am I right that ultimately we're going to have to go to the arbiter of AI before anybody on Earth believes their lying eyes?
Well, I hope not, but artificial intelligence can provide additional information of clarity regarding the images, Richard. So if people go to item number 13 on the website, I did a couple of things.
You mean in my items?
On your item,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Under your items, number 13. Sorry about that. So ChatGPT, it doesn't have the design, what we call convolutional networks, which is kind of very good at image analysis and working with image, although it does have some capability. So I did two things with ChatGPT. The first thing is, in that image, I took your image of the structure and overlay as ChatGPT.
Wait, you mean our computer model from like 1996 with Bob Piertek and me, which was the left hand side. That's a mathematical model of glass and a computer to try to match what we saw on the Apollo data, and it came up with this highly geometric honeycomb kind of glass model.
Right. So I asked ChatGPT to overlay that image onto the image that we're getting from Odyssey.
You can do that in ChatGPT?
You can do a lot with ChatGPT.
Okay.
It's just that people... But yeah. So if people look at image number 13, you can see the two images overlaid, and from my point of view, it looks like the geometric structure is in the same kind of dimensional format as the distorted linear images that we're seeing, Richard. The vertical and the horizontal images, it looks like it's a really good fit. Now, you know, there could be something that ChatGPT is doing to actually, you know, influence the final output. But what we're starting to get here is a high degree of confidence that there is a match between the left image, your model, and also with the energy lines that we're seeing, horizontal and vertical, in the Odyssey image.
No, wait. Hang on. You just said something interesting. Why are you calling them energy lines?
Well, we can talk about that because I've actually seen these images, this structure before on planet Earth.
You have or you have not?
I have.
Oh, where?
So this is where we kind of go into a vibrational plane. You know, we've spoken about vibration and different dimensions before.
Right.
So all I can say is this, I'm not sure how much to share on the air here, but all I can say is this, is there are vibrational structures on the Earth that are not necessarily in the third dimension, but in other aspects, other dimensions that we can experience in our vibrational design as human beings. And so I've actually seen this structure before on planet Earth as a vibrational structure, which is what I sense for seeing here, Richard. I know it sounds out there.
No. So you're saying that the optics that we're seeing from my purported dome are not physical glass, but some kind of energy structure which is being interpreted by both film cameras 50 years ago and digital electronic cameras now as a geometric pattern floating in free space above the moon, but physically it's not really there, right?
Correct. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying, Richard.
Okay, well, that's a very viable model. How would you go about testing it?
So first of all, let's just wrap up with artificial intelligence here. So basically, I took your model image and the Odyssey image, and I said to ChatGPT, look, compare these two images, guess what this lunar structure might be. And I've written this under item 13. And basically, ChatGPT basically gives over a 70% correlation between your image, your model, and looking at the energy lines that we're seeing in the Odysseus image of compatibility. So basically, AI is saying that there are definite similarities between the two images and that the two images have over a 70% alignment in terms of compatibility, and I find that really interesting.
Well, based on a background in AI, would you say this is an independent, neutral observer simply looking at data, and if you got a 70% probability that we're right, it's artificial, what does that tell you in terms of the sociology and science of AI applied to a problem like this?
Well, first of all, is that it definitely is independent. As far as I'm aware, there is no bias towards this kind of assessment. It is an independent view, Richard. And what it shows us is that basically we can go further into analysis of these different types of images we're getting from the moon with artificial intelligence to try and uncover what's really going on, such as the colors that you were speaking about with your guest from the United Kingdom. So artificial intelligence can be really useful, and what I'd love to do is to get a convolutional network to look at these images, because it would be even more accurate in analyzing the compatibility between the two images regarding this artificial structure, Richard.
Well, that's exactly what I want to do, but it's kind of like, you know, when my grandmother used to say, if you don't know your furs, know your furrier.
Right.
You're my furrier when it comes to AI. So I can provide you with the data, both the raw data from Intuitive Machines. I still find the name of the company really amazingly weird, and Andrew and I are going to get into it shortly. But if I provide you with data, both our modified, meaning enhanced, and the original, and you have the appropriate program which can simply compare, like a super trillion flop calculator, are these patterns the same? And if they are, to what degree do they differ? In other words, I'm interested in the sociology. If an AI, which you're saying tonight, says Hoagland has a 70% chance of being right, well, with elections, you only need 51%, which means, you know, both in the current presidential primaries, former President Trump is getting like 54-58% of, you know, red states, and Biden is getting 96-80% of blue states or in these primaries. And we do not argue that either party has won because the preponderance of the evidence counting the votes says they have won. If there's a 70% chance that my model that we built decades ago is accurate compared to current contemporary data, I would think that's a very strong positive, you know, confirmation that we're on the right track and we're looking at something, whether it's glass or energy, it's artificial in terms of its geometry.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Richard. I mean, that's well said. And if you look at the image number 13, all I asked was overlay the two images. I did not ask it to integrate. I did not ask it to do anything other than overlay. And if you look at the overlay, the energy lines are very much aligned with the glass structure that you came up with in the 1960s. It's remarkable.
Well, let me go back to my question. You think it's energy. I think it's physical. I think it's real glass. How do we tell the difference? What's the next part of the experiment to decide which is which?
Well, it would help if we had accurate images from Odysseus, right?
I have a whole week before next week's show. We'll do it on Saturday. I'm going to press them officially. In fact, let me bring this up with you. The thing that makes it so difficult for a half century in getting the truth out of NASA, they're a government agency, right? Mm-hmm. If you read the charter, legally, in law, in the enabling legislation that Eisenhower put on the table and the Congress then voted on and then he signed, setting up NASA as a civilian agency, if you read the charter, it turns out NASA is not a civilian space agency. Do you know why? Because in the charter, the national security state, the executive branch, the Department of Defense, the intelligence agencies, you know, the DCA, the CIA, the DNI, whatever, all these, you know, acronyms, these alphabet soups, they're all ultimately involved in the charter. If you read it carefully, they can censor any data that NASA publishes before they publish under national security.
Well, one can understand that. The question is, assuming that you've got a hit here and the geometric structure is on the moon and has been captured by this camera, the question is,
multiple cameras.
Right. The question is, what is it and what's its purpose?
Yeah. Well, let me go back to the political. The reason this mission presents us with such an extraordinary opportunity for truth is because unlike NASA, which is covered by governmental legal restrictions, in other words, you can't sue the government unless they let you, really, right? IM, Intuitive Machines, is a private corporation. They can be sued. They can be taken to court, just like these various, you know, lawsuits against Trump for past infractions of the law. they can be taken to court. They can be made to be held accountable. They can be made under discovery to reveal all their data, how the cameras are made, how the data is acquired, because they're just off the shelf. They're like NASA used GoPros on Perseverance to go to Mars. They modified them. Well, Intuitive Machines is using commercial cameras. They are modifying to take pictures of the moon. Their modifications are, I am sure, it's part of the public domain. Anyway, the point is, I need a few good lawyers in our audience to contact me. How do we set up a legal process to extract from Intuitive Machines admission details and the truth about what these cameras to a first order? They're completely confirming a model we put on the table at the National Press Club back in March of 1996.
Yeah, they're between a rock and a hard place, really, aren't they? And I guess the person to speak to is Elon Musk, because obviously he runs SpaceX, and you know he probably comes across these issues
all the time. Yeah, but
wait.
Musk was only the truck driver. He only took the mission into space, released it like a butterfly, and Intuitive Machines is running the mission. Musk has nothing to do with the mission. So the people to ask are the people running Intuitive Machines, which I will take the next week with conferring with people in the background to decide, do we actually mount a public citizen action lawsuit against Intuitive Machines to get the truth? Because unlike NASA, they are not prohibited by so-called, Title C or censorship of forbidden technology, because all their technology is U.S. Their photographs are of the moon. According to the record, there's no national defense criteria or excuse for censoring anything from the moon. And if the judge looks at this in camera and comes out with a decree or a judgment or a final ruling that they are, in fact, under the law, able to restrict certain information, that will be an extraordinary admission. There is something up there tonight to hide. Right?
Right. I mean, I've worked with NASA, and I've got the highest admiration for NASA, so we're going to have to agree to disagree. But
see, when you and I are saying NASA, you're assuming all several thousand people that work for the agency are in on it. The way you keep a conspiracy going is you don't tell anybody. You keep the number of players very restricted. You have them sign all kinds of documents legally, putting them in jeopardy if they reveal the truth. And so you kind of see the presence of your quarry by its absence, by its shadow, by its non-existence on the landscape, indicating there's something there, but you're not being allowed to see what the something is. So
right.
I think
and
we
I
go,
have,
ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead.
And I had another thought. It's that if we do a bit of sci-fi stuff and we look at the Borg, right? They had cubes, and they were seen as the enemy of humanity. And I wonder whether your structure from the 90s influenced the kind of Borg design, because there was a narrative.
No. This is.
Ooh, I kind of like.
Yeah, but except
it's very similar, right?
But it's not the truth. We didn't know what we were going to find. We basically gave the computer, Bob Furtick did, his architectural CAD computer that he used to design structures on Earth, you know, to sell buildings. And he inputted my geometric data from our measurements from the Apollo imagery. I had a whole range of Apollo, particularly Apollo 10. He put it in the computer, and that's the model that it spit out. It had no idea what it was doing. It's not AI. It's nowhere near self-conscious, aware, it doesn't understand feedback loops. It was a very simple CAD program. Take the geometry with refraction indices of glass, give us a model geometrically of what had to be producing the imagery we saw in Apollo, and it spit out that lattice, that three-dimensional cubic lattice. Then you go to the Odysseus image, and there's a cubic lattice.
Right. Well, it confirms the research that you did, right? It absolutely
confirms the model, because all we assumed in the model is that something can refract light. Now, in your model, you're saying it's energy. I'm saying it's good old physical glass. And right. We will find out quickly when they bring back samples. Remember, half the lunar materials by weight from Apollo, the samples, the rocks and all that, it's powdered glass. In fact, the percentage of glass at the poles, I think, is going to be much higher than we saw at the Apollo sites because, remember, we're under the protective dome where if stuff is abrading on top, if you're having impacts on the top of this multi-mile thick layer of cubical glass structures, the top's going to be whittled away, right? If there are
right.
If there are transport mechanisms, physical, you know, conduits, tunnels, shafts, whatever, between the top of the dome and the bottom, the glass eroded at the top is going to fall down to the surface and reach the surface miles below eventually, just like dust under your bed accumulates, right?
Right.
Which means when we analyze the composition of the polar regions, if we're right, the percentage of glass should be so much higher that it will show up against the Apollo data from the moon rocks, from the manned missions, as a stunning anomaly. And in fact, the Indian mission reported certain physical chemistry anomalies before their lander died, and we're told it never woke up. Do we know that's true? No, we don't, because all they had to do is put another transmitter on a different frequency in their lander, and they could have conducted all kinds of stuff when it woke up with nobody eavesdropping, looking over their shoulders, looking at the published frequencies, et cetera. In other words, if we're dealing with multi-level complexity of an in-crowd and an out-crowd, and the in-crowd knows the real artificially engineered moon compared to the natural rock everybody else assumes it to be, if you don't tell them where the new transmitter is broadcasting, they can do anything and nobody will know.
Right. Right. It's interesting that it's glass. I find that really curious, actually. But I do sense that, you know, I personally think there's vibration and energy behind the architecture of this. And
well,
maybe
that could
glass.
Be one of the reasons why most of the NASA packages, the experiments on Odysseus, that they now claim they got all kinds of data, 350 megs of data. Those were radio frequency comparison receivers. Like, was somebody concerned if you're going to build a base at the lunar South Pole under an ancient dome, are you interested in the electromagnetic properties in the radio range of what that dome will let you transmit or receive in terms of what's called multipath? Or are you trying to limit out what the limits are to how you can transmit data in the future in the radio spectrum and not with lasers, because, of course, lasers and glass do not mix well.
No, that's very true, actually. That's very interesting. I'm going to stick to my guns. I think that there's a vibration energy behind this, and it may well be in the third dimension. It's projected as glass. But he's held together by energy and vibration of a...
Well, we have another question, which is, if this thing is as ancient as I think it is, meaning it was built between when the moon was brought to the solar system from somewhere else, which Ron and I do agree on, then why was it built?
One of a few.
What was its purpose? Why did Nova Spivak ask me, you know, last week, well, what would the purpose of a dome be? Domes are usually built to shield you from something, bear in, to keep radiation out, to filter sunlight so you don't fry under ultraviolet. You can think of all kinds of usages of a simple dome. If you make it a smart dome, if you make it an energy construct, then you might be blurring the lines between a physical matrix required to carry the energy and at a higher level energy form, which uses that matrix as a means of forming itself and operating in 3D. I don't think we're really that far apart. I just want more data. I want more evidence.
Exactly. Well, if we get better images, I can run it through convolutional networks and we can see what it looks like. But I agree with you on that last point.
Well, I will send you the best imagery that I'm getting, both from overt and covert sources, and then you'll report back to us what you find when you put them through the AI processing.
Sure, absolutely.
Excellent.
But I do like this idea that maybe, you know, if the moon did come from another part of the universe, then this could be the anchor of either observation or the anchor of the energy that actually moved it across the universe. I mean, I'm really curious about this dome structure now. I want to know what it's all about. It's just
well, I'm in total agreement, and we need more data, and I think I know where I can get some of it. Let me bring now everybody in. I want to start with Andrew, because Andrew, you and I are going to do something in the last half hour to kind of lay out a meta political economic model. So why don't we start now? We got about 4 minutes till the bottom of the hour, and then everybody can kind of chime in.
Sure, sure. Where do we want to go first? My items here?
Yeah. Well, okay. First of all, this started because of Copperfield's bizarre experiment. Nova assured me off the air that he is using a technology. They're still working on it, but it's not on the moon. He said categorically, it's not activating, in your idea, the ancient dome around the moon. It's another model, and he did kind of hint that it may be have something to do with something in space between the Earth and the moon. Because I said to him off air, I said, well, are you somebody in Singapore and somebody in London and somebody in Taiwan going to be able to look up at the moon and everybody simultaneously see it disappear? And he said that's what they're trying to do. And then he hinted that it might be a technology, but not on Earth, somewhere between Earth and moon. And I just wonder, is Novak fully in the loop? And would he have any reason to know any further details? Because his mission is over. He's landed the library. It's sitting there. It'll sit there for a billion years. And he can be very comfortable and happy because he's succeeded now in two archives where human archives recently have never gone.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, this is very interesting, Richard, because what we started to dig up, folks, is there's a bit of a history here about using the moon for a number of different reasons, and all of them are basically commercial. And if we go to my really quickly, Richard, people can look at this as we speak because it's a really short little ad, but it's a little commercial. These days, we would call it an animatic because it's just like a little animation, and an animatic is usually used to show the client what the commercial will look like when it's shot. So it's usually like still pictures that are put in place, so they're almost an animation, but it's rough. And this is an example of it. So this is number five, and the title is Coke wanted to put their logo on the moon, and it's a really short little ad, and it's kind of a little bit goofy. It's got I think the Apollo lunar probe with a little pipe on it, Richard, kicking out smoke. It's really kind of cute. But the
okay,
whole
I'll tell
question,
you all, we're at the bottom of the hour. Let's hold this.
Yes.
My guest this morning, Andrew Curry, is going to teach us that the interests of commercials and commercial entities and commercial exploitation of the moon is not a recent phenomenon. In fact, it turns out to be very, very old, which we'll show you when we return. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. If you touch that dial now, you won't find out the ending. We'll be right back.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Here we are in the Lanham and Champion on the Other Side of Midnight on this Saturday night, now Sunday morning, in the Land of Enchantment here in the deserts of New Mexico. My guests this morning, too numerous to mention, look at the logo, and they'll all introduce themselves when they come on. They'll say, I'm Ron, or I'm, you know, Andrew, or I'm whatever. We're looking, I think, at a real benchmark change in history. Because like NASA before them, this mission has given us amazing data, but they haven't given us the amazing truth. What's behind the data? Remember, that model you see in my item number 3 was created almost 20 years ago based on Apollo imagery. Flash forward the film 20 years later, a mission to which we have no connection, cameras we have no understanding of, mission planners that we have never talked to, published data AI says has a 70% chance of being identical to what we proposed over 20 years ago. So what's driving all this secrecy? Why? I mean, obviously, intuitive machines cannot possibly claim, unless they admit what we say is there, that there's anything of a national security concern on the moon. I mean, good grief. So why are and what are they hiding or putting it out in a way, very Emily Dickinson, to where it's there? You can look at it, you can interpret it, but if they don't give you the background data, you can't come up with an appropriate, defensible analysis of what the truth is. And is that part of the objective for the commercialization, the gold rush of the moon? Andrew?
Thank you, Richard. Well, again, so my and this ties into not only on our sort of ongoing theme of this sort of commercialization, not only of the moon, but of the solar system, and, you know, essentially a gold mine times a trillion out there, and we know that that's tied, Richard, with the technology more than
let me out for everybody one incredibly obvious commercial thing that this company might lay legal claim if they're publishing data showing the dome. What if they figure out through their next set of missions what's holding up the dome? Suppose it's not physical pillars made of glass. Suppose it's little pods that are literally tugging upward as hard as their little hearts can tug, made of some kind of material, a super cavorite, which under the lunar gravity field, like a buoy, is trying to reach the surface of an ocean, and it's literally floating, anti-gravity, vector pointing up, and all the cabling and all the supports of this dome, either glass or energy and glass or energy, a matrix, is basically being suspended by something which, if intuitive machines could find it, capsule it, send it back to Earth, deconstruct it in terms of engineering, and duplicate it, could make them $1 trillion in their spare time, take over the transportation sector of Earth, make transporting goods everywhere, including to Gaza, as trivial as sending an anti-gravity device anywhere you wanted it, without propellers, without fuel, without oversight, without anything. That one technology alone, if it's real, and a company like Intuitive Machines could corner the market, could make them own Wall Street. Just one incredible advanced Clark third law, impossible to distinguish from magic technology. And I can write down a list of 50 incredible technical advances that I'm expecting to find in ancient ET ruins, not on the moon, but elsewhere in the solar system. And are we looking then at a group of corporations that have known for some time this is going to be the gold rush of all times? Get in while the going is good, keep your mouth closed, sign your NDAs, and you are going to make a bloody fortune that you couldn't spend in 100 lifetimes.
Richard?
Yes. Ron?
Could I toss in a thought here? Perhaps what's necessary to grab that technology is understanding what those fields of energy are and how to find them, and not specifically the technology. In other words, you could give somebody the device you're talking about, and unless they understood what it was supposed to manipulate, wouldn't be much good. I cite two visual examples of it that are obviously have technology intended behind them. Two good TV shows. On Firefly, there was an episode where they went where the rich people live, and they were mostly living in floating estates.
Yes,
which were perfectly
floating
safe,
in midair.
Safely levitating, and that means that whatever was doing it was not requiring constant energy to make it viable, but were simply riding on these fields. You know,
well,
and
one of my models is that the fields are created, the gateway between dimensions, the hyperdimensional physics, is gated by the geometry of the material. If you make the right geometry, the object, instead of being pulled down by Earth's gravity or the moon's gravity, will try to float. It'll try to get as far away from the moon as possible, and you could use it as anchors for something to hold up a whole dome suspended from overhead, from basically what they call that, a kind of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, which appears illogical and unscientific because we don't understand the physics. Yeah, let me go back to Andrew. So Andrew, if this political economic model and everybody's suddenly pushing lunar economy, lunar economy, lunar economy, there is no lunar economy without what we're talking about. Zero. There is no value in a moon rock on Earth for anybody except for the first few collectors. And in terms of energy and oxygen and hydrogen and all that, yeah, that's good for inter-solar system commerce with rockets. But if Barry 1 is showing us the new direction, a field propulsion that doesn't need fuel, you're not going to need the moon as a landing place for refueling. So the only value that Andrew and I have been looking at really in depth and in terms of potential shattering implications economically and politically is what's there, the ancient ET knowledge, technologies, libraries, materials, sources of God knows what. I mean, there is no limit yet because we don't know the limits of this ancient civilization, but if they could build a dome around the moon, they could probably do anything that we would define as magic. Andrew.
Well, Richard, before we dive too deeply into that, I wanted to go back to something that Matthew said, and I think kind of getting the feeling Rod is feeling the same way, and that is this idea that this and again, I know for lots of people listening and looking at the images, they're still kind of like scratching their head. You know, Nova's trying to figure it out at the beginning of these shows. Where's the gloss? You know, we have to turn up the gain and do the contrast to get it. And, well, I see the forms and patterns. I've seen it over and over again.
Well, look at number 10. Look at the reflections, the ripples in the top of the dome. And when I say top,
Can I jump in?
Yes, Richard.
Go ahead. Yes. Ruggiero, if you look at my number 9.
Oh, this is Ruggiero. Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, if you look at my image number 9, which is an enhanced view of the moon from the Mars Nectaris image you supplied,
So that the blue is the proposal for the dome. In between the moon, which is the yellow, is a space. Okay, and if that's what we're
well,
seeing,
on my image, it looks multicolored.
Yeah, so the blue bit's multicolored, right? But then as you get close to the moon, there's a gap.
Yeah, and you see this multicolored, multi-prismatic. The dome has layers, levels. You can see it. You can see it in my, let me scroll up here, look at my images. Hang on, let me get to the right one. You go to my image number 9. Look at 8 and 9. It's got tiers, it's got layers, it's got levels. It's banked in courses like balcony seats at a theater.
Mm.
It's a very complex geometric structure. I don't think it's energy, Matthew. I love the idea. I think it can be energized, but I think we're looking at just the glass. And when you say to yourself, well, why would it be glass? Glass is the most pervasive material available on the moon, on Earth, on Mars, on all solid planets. And in a vacuum, we know from the work at Lawrence Livermore, or I forget what laboratory did it, the glass is 20 times stronger than steel. Glass in a vacuum can be made into incredible mechanical stuff. So if you have unlimited energy, unlimited material, and it has all kinds of properties you want, meaning you can see through it, you can make it opaque, you can make it shield radiation, you can design any geometry you want. If you use available material, I would say glass all over the solar system is the material that I would choose to make things of, because there's so much of it and it's so malleable in forms of technology that we haven't even begun to manufacture on a commercial basis, but have done some work in the lab. Glasses are really interesting in and of themselves.
Yeah, Arthur C. Clarke mentions it in his space elevator.
Yeah. Book.
He talks about using the glass because it won't have any contaminants when it's made in the vacuum.
Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so much stronger. See, it's the water. It gets in the glass. It's not even a crystal. It's more like a frozen solid. And then you can make other kinds of glass. In other words, designer glass to go with a designer solar system, to go with a designer playpen for human consciousness to do whatever it's supposed to do.
Mm.
Now, if you look quickly at my number 11 and 12, when Odysseus landed, it kicked up all kinds of crud. And they posted these wildly obscure images. Well, you can take them into imaging programs and sort out what's in the front and what's in the back. And 11 and 12 is a wide angle of the landing at the moment of landing where the landing legs broke because of the force of the landing. And number 12 is an enlargement. And if you look to the left on both, that is material crud flying up, being coughed up by the engine. But it's also flying in front of a background geometry, which you can see at the horizon there, particularly in number 11 on the left-hand side. That's more geometry of the glass. And it's acting like it's getting light from the setting sun, which is only 14 degrees above the horizon, Greg calculated. And it's giving you prismatic refractions through glass. I'm not quite sure, Matthew, why an energy pattern would have the same refractive index pattern as good old glass. And again, in Occam's razor, if I have the two to decide between, I'll pick glass over energy because energy requires energy and glass simply requires it persists and it survives in some form. Even if it's thin, it still will have the optical refractive properties of when it was much thicker and much denser. So that's what I think we're seeing is confirmation in those surface images, again, of the model. And if they won't tell us in the next week or two, then I'm really serious about let's look into a lawsuit to force them as a private corporation to tell us the truth. And the way you do it, I think, remember, they sold their stockholders that they would develop a reliable company which would make a profit and which would provide a service, right? Well, to do that, they have to understand the full environment and make the environment known to their customers so their customers can basically evaluate the probability of investing money that will make the money or investing money in something that will crash. So under disclosure protocol, I think intuitive machines can be forced to tell us the truth because customers should demand the full truth so they can weigh the risks of sending their stuff to the moon on a mission that doesn't acknowledge there are problems, but we have to keep the problem secret because you can't know.
Richard?
Yes, Ron?
I see a problem there.
Good.
In that, remember Kentucky Fried Chicken? I mean, not that
yeah,
it has gone away, but the secret recipe of the, what was it, 16 secret herbs and spices?
Well, it even goes back earlier, and I want to get back to Andrew.
Wait a second. Yeah, what I just said makes no sense unless I get the other half of the sentence out. The point is that when he was finally taken to court, or the company was, I mean, he was a spokesman for his own company. You know? It wasn't even from Kentucky. It turned out it was salt and pepper and the normal things in the kitchen. It was there was absolutely nothing secret or special
about
it.
Yeah, but there's
a
real difference. And Coke earlier, I was going to go back to Andrew's Coke commercial. Coke had a secret recipe. Remember Coke Original?
Oh, well, they do.
This is apples and oranges. Matthew says he's uncomfortable talking about lawsuits. Fine. You don't have to be part of it. I'm the one running this part of the show, and I will find a lawyer or lawyers to do this as a test because intuitive machines should be able to keep secret proprietary technology. They should not be able to keep secret the environment that they have found.
What secrets do you want them to reveal?
The
subject-wise.
The dome. That there's a dome.
Well, so that's okay. The barristers will say, well, that's an opinion. You want them to leak their opinion.
No, I want them to leak their data.
It doesn't establish.
I want them to leak the data. Look, this is not a magical thingy. This is not something that's only seen by some people and not seen by others. It's seen by everybody.
Yeah, but you're putting
them. Go ahead.
You're putting overwhelming importance on some data that is, and I'm not saying that you're trepidations are misguided or anything, but that's not the kind of stuff that you can bring out with a lawsuit. You just can't.
I don't know that, and you don't. You're not a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer.
You can't. Yeah. Well, no judge will take it. That's what I'm telling you.
You don't know that.
I don't know.
Until we try,
not enough to build a case on.
You don't know that, and I don't know that. So let's stop.
I'd rather have them as friends than enemies.
Who?
They're
going to
get
Who?
Awfully mad.
Who?
Intuitive machines.
What are they going to do to me? What are they going to do to me? Come to my house?
Well, it's not what they're going to do to you. They're just going to say, we don't want to have anything to do with this. You won't have any public display of anything. They don't have to.
Yes, they do. Under their NASA contract, they do.
NASA does.
They are a contractor to NASA and vice versa, covered by the charter. Look, this is why we need real lawyers to sort this out. Some people get uncomfortable.
Sure.
But that's why you have a legal system, to get people to tell you the truth who don't, for whatever reason, want to tell you the truth. Andrew, please, we got 10 minutes left. Gosh.
Well, anything would let Ron talk. Go.
I can bring in something because the topic of the glass dome, the topic of glass and the moon and secrets goes back in history about 400 years. When the first optical telescope made from glass lenses were built together in 1609, and Galileo. He used it. He didn't invent the telescope, but he used the invention of the telescope to show what is ongoing on the moon. He looked at the moon, and he wanted to prove the Copernican heliocentric worldview model. And he was the first one who used the new invention of the glass optical lens telescope to prove it. And he was supported by the Roman Church first. He was supported by them. Then he presented his observations of the moon through his telescope to the Venetian Senate in 1609, published it in 1610 in his book. And then suddenly the Roman Church was suing him, that and finally decided that it was officially heretic what he published, and he should stop that. It's an interesting history about secrets, glass, and so on.
Well, the good thing is you don't need to land on the moon to determine the existence of the dome, which means other private missions, other people who can basically get a ride share from Musk and send a spacecraft, a CubeSat, to the moon and put it into orbit, which is doable within the price of a high-end automobile now, less than 100 grand. They could put cameras on and take photographs of this and confirm what's there, regardless of whether these other companies agree or not, don't agree. In other words, nobody owns the moon. Nobody can forbid you to take pictures of it. In fact, we have all kinds of imagery, which I've shown, of talented amateurs from Earth, from here on terra firma, on opposite sides of the world, who are taking pictures from the Earth, showing exactly the same thing that we're seeing in the Odyssey, in the Odysseus imagery. So it's only a matter of time. Somebody is going to be first. Somebody is going to break through. Somebody is going to be able to literally, you know, corner the market in terms of what's there. But in order to do that, they have to know what's there, and that gives them a legal mechanism, I think, and I obviously need to consult with real legal experts, but my understanding of how these torts work is that you cannot claim proprietary material that isn't yours. It's in fact part of nature. So, Andrew?
Well, we're going to have to condense this. I'd like to suggest, Richard, that we have another show at some point.
We're obviously going to pick this up next Saturday. We're going to continue this because by next Saturday, I may have notes back from Durst. We may have specs on the camera. I may be able to get certain people in the press conferences to ask the key questions about the cameras, because frankly, I think they're made deliberately complex so people can't look at them and either understand what they're seeing, or as some tonight have said, well, you can't really support what you're seeing because it all could be lens flare. So they want to keep the ambiguity. That's the way you keep secrets anymore. You keep everything ambiguous. It's all fake news. You don't know where to turn, what process to apply. And so the people hiding things can get away with anything, up to and including murder.
However, and I know we're really close to the edge here, the moon, which has, again, in your, as Richard would say, copious spare time, have a look at number five when you have a chance, folks. The moon has been used as a concept for a billboard for a long time. What I'm trying to say here is that it's literally, okay, ambiguity. Has been, has been like a topic of this whole endeavor for us researching it and others. But in advertising, things are very clear. I think Ron was stumbled upon, well, I don't know if he stumbled, but I think he's absolutely correct when he said salt and pepper. Because, listen, I was dealing with a director I work with a lot. He's from L.A., big-time commercial director. And he's in Finland right now shooting a Citroën French car commercial. And he was grumbling away on Skype, and he said to me, you can't trust a country that has only Pepsi available. Because he's a Coke drinker. And I'm telling you, clarity is going to come from the advertising and what we do. And I know we're so close, but I want to share one quick, really real story. In 1999, there was a Coca-Cola executive named Steve Coonan who proposed the idea to turn the moon literally into a billboard by lasers on the surface of the moon, and at the time
from the earth
Jim Garvin, he was the chief scientist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He said it's actually possible but probably improbable, and he said we were probably about 10 years away. And he said what they could do is scientists at the time could bounce lasers off the moon and illuminate only the something the size of a tennis ball. He says in order to have an advertisement be seen by people on Earth, the laser light would need to be seen by people, or the laser light would need to cover an area about the land size, about half the land size of Africa. So that was 99. Now, this kind of ties the bow, at least for the concepts around Copperfield. If he's not indeed using something on the moon, maybe he's figured out something to be able to project on the moon. So anyways, there's a lot more involved. There's a lot of interesting things. Nova touched on it when he said there's a lot of stuff that was deposited with Odysseus, including Richard, two artists who specialized in metallic metal transparent artwork. Talk about messaging, and I would have loved to have gone into it tonight, but cool. Maybe we could do it another time.
Well,
so there's
we will do another show on this next Saturday. You know, everybody's got their markers down, and we will know a lot more from the mission. Who knows what we're going to see?
Yeah, and the messaging is so clear. Like, I really could have would have loved to talk about these artists who were basically having a bitch slap with each other about who gets there first, excuse my language. But it's very, very interesting because associated with these artists are NFTs. So everything with these artists is about guys, well, at this point, two guys that are really pricey in their artwork and who are going to make a lot of money, they claim, for charity, et cetera. A lot of marketeering going on, Richard, a lot of messaging going on, and a lot of it has to do with transparency and reflection.
Yep. Okay, we've got about 3 minutes. Matthew.
Hello.
Yeah, thoughts.
I think first of all is that the work that you did with the dome in the 90s, obviously that looks like there's some kind of similarity with the energy that we're seeing. So my thoughts are, I'm really curious. And, you know, humanity is just starting to uncover the mysteries of the universe. And maybe we're starting to uncover the first one that's tangible.
If I can get you a set of imagery and we have a kind of a paper trail, a kind of a, you know, chain of custody for the evidence, and you put it through whatever AI programs you're using, and I would use different ones to see if each program agrees with the other, that kind of thing, it should be able to move us in the direction of more certainty as to what we're looking at. Because I just don't understand why everybody with such overwhelming evidence going all the way back to 1946 and Project Diana, which bounced radar at UHF TV frequencies off the moon and had a delayed echo. And I showed the graphs when I did the show with Joseph Farrell last week. The echo obviously is the energy, the radio waves rattling around. No. And that's why NASA put on this mission a set of receivers to look at all different wave bands to see which wavelengths are interfered with and which are clear, obviously in preparation for trying to do a lunar base under a dome, which is much thicker than at the Apollo areas. Okay, we basically have no more time. I want to thank all my guests this morning, one and all. It's been really amazing what we've figured out in our groping human level way. We will continue this conversation next Saturday. Tomorrow night, we're going radically different. We're going back to England to Stonehenge and the cockamamie idiotic British plan to use bulldozers to build a 3-mile-long tunnel under Stonehenge, which if they do it, it will destroy it. So join Maria Wheatley and others, and we'll talk about that tomorrow night. So until then, remember, same time, same bat channel, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone, and keep looking at the moon.